So today I have the pleasure of interviewing Mr. Todd Williams. So about Todd Williams, he is the founder of Monroe Jiu-Jitsu, a Michigan native that made his name through distance running. He was a state champion and All-American at Monroe High School in 1987 before moving on to even greater things, where he actually made two United States Olympic teams in 1992 Barcelona and in 1996 in Atlanta. After retiring from professional distance running in 2002, he immediately started Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and self-defense training. After 6,000 hours and 8 years of hard work, he received his black belt and certifications in self-defense from the legendary coral belt Luiz Flores on January 22, 2011. At this point, Todd created RunSafer.com and began teaching runners, joggers, and walkers how to be safer while out exercising. He has conducted over 500 safety workshops in 35 states, as well as instructing students in Jacksonville, Florida, at the Luiz Flores Academy. He has also had the opportunity to instruct law enforcement, as well as the National Guard. Todd has trained and learned from some of the best in the world, including world championships, people like Marcelo Garcia, Bernardo Farrell, Wellington, Mingington Diaz, Andre Galvao, Salo Ribeira, Zan Ribeira, Augusto Tanaku, Helio Sancho, Borez, Lucas Lapri, Mikey Musanechi, Josh Hinger, JT Torres. Todd wants Monroe Jiu-Jitsu to be the great place to learn a great martial arts that can change people's lives. Welcome to the show, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu third degree black belt now and former Olympian Todd Williams.
The interim of sarcasm, the naughty professor, to your whack-ass marmalade.
It's T-Bone from T-Bone and Chick Brew in the Morning. Now available in podcast format. Simply search for the T-Bone and Chick Brew podcast, available wherever fine podcasts are sold.
All right, guys, he is here. Welcome to the show, Professor Todd Williams.
Appreciate you having me. Love to talk about jiu-jitsu, and you know, when you invited me on the show, I'm like, man, I can't wait. Because anytime I get a chance to talk about jiu-jitsu, I can pretty much stay awake 24-7 and talk about it all day long.
All right, so before I let you get in your jiu-jitsu thing, I want everybody to know that you weren't always a jiu-jitsu guy. You have been competitive your entire life so much. You were an All-American at high school, and you made two Olympic teams. Could you tell us a little bit about your high school journey? What sport you played?
Yeah, so I mean, the journey really starts back with me. You know, I was a really hyper kid. You know, my parents would, you know, they're like, get outside, you're going to do something. From as soon as I was 4 years old, I was in a swimming pool. I was doing age group swimming really early. I started wrestling at the Palestrio Club locally here. I remember my last certificate was a 61 pound. I got third place in the state at 61 pounds.
Nice.
So I was always active. And my parents, I had a great family. So it's like, from that, I went to baseball, basketball, football, and, you know, I just always stayed involved in sports. And then my football coach in ninth grade finally looked at me and he's like, you know, you're doing well out here in conditioning and you're doing really good in football, but he goes, I think you should try cross country and try track. And so that spring in ninth grade, I went over to the track, and really with minimal training, I ran 4:32 in the mile.
Wow.
Off of on a cinder track, because I'm old, and the cinder track was an old track. And that's when the track coach goes, nah, I think you're not going to play football again. you're going to run cross country. And so that's when I met a lot of, you know, I always talk, when I talk about influencers in your life and positive people in my life, that was my high school coach in running. And Coach Borat was a guy that just, he saw that I had the work ethic. And he ran in college with a couple of Olympians at Miami of Ohio. And so when he saw my work ethic in my town, he's like, if you can keep working hard and stay straight, hang out with the right people, you got a really good chance to go to college with this. And, you know, that's all I had to hear. So from that point forward, I believed whatever he said. My dad would, if I didn't listen to my coach, my dad would have, it wouldn't have been good. So my coach said, and going to Monroe High School here, and now that I moved back home, great experiences here. I made, you know, winning a couple state titles and then making All-American and then earning a full ride to the University of Tennessee. And then I was kind of off to the races.
Nice. Well, I definitely agree. I think what you said about a positive influence, we had somewhat the same trajectory. My granddad was a boxer and he was the warden of the prison. So he kind of always had us in some combat sport. But when I got to school, I was so hyper. And I kind of had the same experience. I just happened to bump into a teacher, and she was a cross-country teacher, a cross-country coach as well, and she was the teacher of the year. And I still remember her name to this day. She just retired. Her name is Rosalind Hoffman, and this was like my super teacher. she got me into running, and I used to run a lot of distance, but I was kind of crazy. I would get upset and run. And then realize I was in another city and have to call my parents. She was very dedicated. She would buy me books, like little fantasy books and stuff. Bought me an entire Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter collections. So she kept me engaged physically, and then very like mentally made school interesting and fun for me. And I kind of, What about you, Taylor? I forgot to say my professor Taylor is with us today as well, guys.
Yeah, my dad was a boxer. He did all kinds of sports, taekwondo, things like that. About the time my parents got divorced, my dad started getting into jiu-jitsu. He had a knee injury, and they were kind of like, you're never going to be able to box again. You're never going to be able to do any kind of like sports or physical activity. And one of his friends took him to his first jiu-jitsu class. My instructor just started teaching and didn't have a kid's class yet. So as soon as he started a kid's class, my dad was like, he was hooked already. And he was like, my kids have to do this. So
nice.
I swam, did field hockey, done jiu-jitsu my whole life. But you know, same thing, like my parents just had to keep me in sports because I just was a, you know, ball of energy. So that's where I was, you know, I wasn't really much good at field hockey. I guess the biggest thing was I was just really aggressive. Like, so I could always get to the ball. I've never been a super good runner, but like, you know, when you're behind, you have to go get it. That's like my little spurts that I would get. But other than that, we've had the jiu-jitsu since day one. And that's been my like backbone for me.
See, that's good. Now I got two technical questions for Todd, but I'm going to save them till later about short people and running. How tall are you, Todd?
I'll say 5'10", but more like 5'9", 5'10". But see, when I ran, I was 5'10", 138, right?
Okay.
Now I'm 5'10", 205.
All right, so I'm going to save my technical, my shin splints hurt when I run question for later. So you got to your college in Tennessee. Where are you from originally? No.
Oh, it's Southeast Michigan and Monroe, Michigan. We're right in between Detroit, Michigan, and Toledo, Ohio. So, you know, I can make it to a Tiger game, you know, 30 minutes away. I can make it to a Toledo Mud Hens if I'm into baseball. I look at the Pistons or Detroit, and then I can head down to Ohio as well.
All right.
So I was gone for a while. So I graduated in 1987 from high school, and then I went to University of Tennessee, and I lived in Knoxville from 87 until 2002. And then I moved to Jacksonville, Florida from 2002 until 2016. And then my kids grew up. Now I have two daughters, 24 and 21. I love them to death, but they're older now. They're doing their own thing. And Brooke and Bailey, once they got out of high school, then I wanted to move back home and be around my mom. My mom's older, so I'm back in my hometown now. People think I'm nuts about the beaches of Florida. I come back to Michigan, but I love my hometown, man. My hometown is 18,000 people. It's a small town. I'm a small town guy. I'm a Midwest guy. I just love being back home.
Yeah,
especially at my own school. It's great doing something good for a town that's they need good stuff here. And I'm glad I can be part of a healthy movement downtown instead of bars, more bars, and bars.
Yeah, I definitely understand that. So, one, the world is very small because I'm from Jacksonville, Florida. So it's actually pretty cool that you live there and your black belt instructor is there as well. So before I get into that, how did your college days go as far as just your running journey? And how did you end up transitioning from college to, you know, your Olympic team in 1992?
So, you know, my dad was really disciplined. You know, he was strict. My dad was really strict. So I really didn't do anything. I loved running. And once I got into it, all I wanted to do was run. I ran as a senior in high school. I was running 84 to 90 miles a week. I did everything I could possibly do to be national champ, to be the best in the United States as a high school runner, to earn my full ride. Once I got into college, my freshman year, I got away from my pops and I started messing around a little bit. Yeah, and you know, it was a wake up call for me because I was all SEC. I was still one of the top runners in the Southeast Conference. You know, at Tennessee, I was beating guys from University of Florida, LSU, and I finished second in the conference in cross country. But then as the year went on, I started to make a few mistakes and the coach pulled me in his office. He goes, you know, if you want to be and you want to maximize your gifts, you better stop hanging out so late. You better stop making bad decisions. And that was another influencer in my life, you know. I had my guy in ninth grade that told me I need to stop playing football and run track. I had a great high school coach in Dave Bork. And then my college coach was, you know, he just shot it straight. He's like, you know, if you want to go on and make the Olympics, if you even have a chance or even to make All-American, let's straighten it up. And so my sophomore, junior, and senior year, I buckled down and, you know, I was running 100 mile weeks. Everything was focused on being the best NCAA runner and you know, that I could possibly be. And by my senior year, I was MVP of the NCAA at the national championships. I led Tennessee to a national title. Nice. And then I was fortunate to earn a professional contract to run with Adidas. And that's when I really took off because all I had to focus on was running. So, you know, I went to Europe, I lived in London. I got to compete all over the world and against the best guys in the world and just do nothing but train. And I got to do that for 12 years or almost 12 years straight, you know, and it was a dream come true. But anytime I give talks to kids or if I'm camps or any presentation, it comes down to, man, hard, hard work, staying healthy, living the right lifestyle, hanging out with the right people. It's, you know, everybody knows that they should do that to be the best they can be, but a lot of people don't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very true. You gotta kind of stay zoned in, focused. It's a very narrow mind you kind of have to have if you want to succeed. And it's difficult because everybody around you, or a lot of people around you, are making very different decisions. And it always seems like they're having so much fun until you look at them 15 years later. And I had that wake up call myself. It was actually pretty sad, but it was in 2015 when I got out of the military and I was like, all right, I had a relatively successful career. I had one of my friends call me right when I got back to Jacksonville and he just said, hey man, what can you do to help me get in the Navy? And then the words that followed were, I'm 29, I have two kids, I don't have a job, and I'm starting to feel bad about myself. And my, you know, reaction was, shit, I would have started to feel bad at 22 years old, you know, but I was, yeah. You know, I was happy that he reached out to me, and the cutoff age for the Navy at that time was 33. So I was like, I'm going to help you get in. They'll help you get your GED. I said, you've already kind of jacked up in life. This is your last shot. They're going to scream at you and you're not used to being talked to that way. And from Jacksonville, Florida. But maybe you should have had somebody scream at you years ago.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
And so he's actually still in right now. He's a lifer. He's doing pretty good. But it's just like those small little people every now and then that whisper in your ear, maybe you should be doing this. And then this brief moment where you humble yourself enough to listen, you know.
Yeah, and you know, another thing I always think of is the people in your life too. Like, I'm in the process of writing a book, especially when the pandemic started. I was home, you know, being here by myself. So, you know, like the influences in your life and some of the things you would hear, like, man, he's too short to run fast. So he'll never pass his ACT. He'll never get into college. He'll never get a college degree. He'll never make all SEC. Mm. Those are the things that would drive me. Like when I talk about my successes, the biggest thing I remember are my failures. Like, so my book is based on 30 failures in my life that helped me. In my mind, they were failures, but you know, like not making Allstate as a sophomore and I thought I was going to make Allstate. Those little things in my brain that stuck in there are, you know, people saying things they couldn't make it. Those are the things that drive me. Even to this day, like, there's no way a jiu-jitsu school will make it in Monroe. Really?
Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's good. So
that's what makes me go. It's not the accomplishments I'm just wired. Anything that's a negative or a failure in my mind, I'm gonna try to reverse it.
Nice. Well, that's a nice way to look at life as a whole. I try my best to do that in the same. And sometimes I think a lot of times when people tell you can't do something, it's kind of projection. What they're saying is I can't do it.
and
there's, he's been dead for a few years here, but he was a World War II veteran. He was a history guy named Gore Vidal. He used to say, you know, there's plenty of room at the bottom. And so it's kind of that mentality.
I mean, I tell my kids class that, or, you know, even some of my adults, like, anybody can be average. Anybody can just go through life and not try or not. Like, even when you're talking about competition in jiu-jitsu, you don't have to compete if you're at my school, but it's cool to go outside the box if it's once a belt level or if it's twice a belt level.
Yeah.
Because it's something that even if you lose, most people, a high percentage, will never get inside that circle and smack hands.
Yeah.
And anything, like, just like running, or when you put yourself out there, most people don't, they never want to put themselves out there. They don't want to work hard. They don't want to make the sacrifices. And that's the reason successful people are successful and a majority of the people are average.
That's very true. There's an old saying, you lose all the shots, you miss all the shots you refuse to take.
Yeah,
I try to do the same thing in my gym. Like, you know, we don't have people in our gym that are like world champion. We don't have world champions in our gym right now, but we have people that are interested in competing. And it's like, I tell them the same thing. We have people that are just hobbyists. And I go, hey, even if you're not competing, you're still a part of helping these people that are competing get to where they need to be. And, you know, that's kind of just like the thing I always try to say. And then, you know, hey, you don't have to be a competitor, but you should definitely try it at least once. Some people hate competing and they realize that when they get out there.
Right.
But most of them get out there like, oh, I'm so much better at jiu-jitsu than I thought. I'm trying to tell you that, bud.
Yeah. I think what's cool about having a school too is seeing people grow, you know, and like, what I'll do is like, when you think about like the little pyramid of nerves of competition. So when you first walk in the gym, that's the first part, right? That's super nerve wracking, just to walk in and sign a waiver. But then when their first sparring match, nobody's really watching them. And then if you have an in-house tournament, just like, you know, this person versus that person, but everybody's watching. And then you step it up to a dual meet against another school, but it's only the dual meet. And then I always look at it like that. It's like, you're nervous, but if you train hard, it's unexplainable until you get in there and smack hands. It's like, it's different than running. Like running, even if I ran the Olympic Stadium with 85,000 people watching me, it was, to me, if I do a dual meet with me and I smack hands and just that school's looking at me and that school, the intent, it's a feeling you can't describe. I love it.
All right. On that note, I will allow you guys, these two professors, to talk about jiu-jitsu. So you did the 92 and 96 Olympics. How did you transition? How did that transition happen from being a runner? I know you had some wrestling experience to jiu-jitsu. What was your jiu-jitsu introduction?
In my mind, I thought, okay, I'm going to finish up, retire from distance running. I was 32-ish, 33. And I honestly was going to take a full year because I'd been involved in sports since age 4. So I never took a full year in just I don't know, call it normal. I was, whatever normal meant to me, I don't know what that is. I don't know what normal is. But I'm like, I want to take a year and just, I don't know, eat Big Macs. I don't know. and that lasted about a couple of days because my body was so used to exercise. So used to, and so that's the reason I thought I was going to lift, and I thought I was going to get like, I thought I was going to be a bodybuilder, right?
Oh,
so I
snap.
So I thought I was going to look like my man up here, Brandon Copeland, right?
So
that lasted, you know, I was, the gym was across the street. I looked over to my right from, you know, where I lived in Knoxville, and that's when I saw the Progressive Martial Arts Gracie Baja Jiu Jitsu. And I just happened to go in there in an afternoon class, and in 2002, not that many people really did jiu-jitsu, you know, so it's like, I walked in there was nobody in the afternoon class except, you know, Seneca was sitting at the desk, and he said, "Do you want to try a class?" He goes, "Do you have any experience at all?" I said, "I wrestled when I was sub 100 pounds, you know, years and years ago." He goes, "Okay," so he taught me like a outside trip, and he saw, I think it was a mount escape, and, you know, that was kind of the introduction, like, this is what jiu-jitsu can do for you, and he goes, "You want to roll around a little bit?" You know, one of my first class. So I said, "Okay." So he goes, "Just act like we're wrestling in the backyard, you know." And it was in broken English, you know. He goes, "Just come after me." So I'm trying to get him in a headlock because everybody goes for the headlock, right? They want to grab your head. And so he just toyed with me, and I told him after, he goes, "You think you'll come back?" And I said, "Oh yeah." I said, "I'll come back tonight." So I started pretty much training twice a day. Nice. That first 5 years, I was on it. Like, I was on, you know. I was probably twice a day for the first 4 or 5 years for sure, and then I was off to the races. I haven't stopped since.
That's great. So just that little connection, and then after you start doing your jiu-jitsu, how long was it before you did your Run Safer program?
Started in end of 2002 with jiu-jitsu, and then I moved to Florida, and then, you know, with my running background, I also got a real job. So in 2009, 2010, I was heading toward my black belt, and then I got a sales rep job. So I took going from a professional runner to a sales rep job, meaning I had to service accounts that I would sell in Adidas footwear, Adidas apparel, and Adidas accessories. And I would take my product and I would sell into these running stores, you know, so I turned into a sales guy, but at the same time, I would train in every city. So I was in Jacksonville at the time. So I would go to Miami. I'd train at a school. I'd go to Tampa, Rob Kahn, all these different guys in Florida, all the way up to Atlanta with, I've trained with Cobrina. I trained with Jacare. And I learned so much while I was a running sales guy. But that's when I had the idea of Run Safer, because I came back from a sales call and somebody got attacked in Atlanta. I believe it was Atlanta. They were attacked on the run. So they were out for a run on the trail. And somebody came out on them and assaulted them, like grabbed them while they're in this trail, pulled them into the woods and assaulted. So that's when I was driving home and I'm like, you know, it'd be cool to go inside the stores and teach basic escapes and give them an introduction to what jiu-jitsu could potentially do for them if they trained consistently. So if they were assaulted or approached on a walk, jog, or run, that they would have, they'd be better equipped to escape and get out of there. And so that's when I started talking to the store owners. I'm like, what if I put together a company? And I came into your store and we did a 60-minute presentation. Well, as soon as that idea popped, then I started getting a hold of the running companies like Adidas, Nike, Asics, Saucony, Brooks. And they kind of it was a bidding war to be attached to my brand because they wanted Run Safer presented by Asics.
Oh, nice.
So that way when I went inside the stores, the customer that came inside the store and saw this presentation was like, who's responsible for this? ASICS is. Well, the next thing you know, ASICS in that store, the market share started to go up because we're giving them a free safety presentation. And then we're on the news, we're on print. We started doing, you know, going into the community and doing things on behalf of the store inside schools and middle school. So it snowballed. You know, the idea of me running 60,000 miles in two Olympic teams and then earning my black belt after so many hours of training, and I combined those two loves of mine into that company, it was a dream job. You know, so I launched that, it would have been November of 2012, and then it was on. It was Run Safer presented by ASICS up until last year.
All right, great, great, great. So I'm gonna circle back now. That was just something I thought about as a curiosity thing. So when you started your jiu-jitsu journey, and were you a jiu-jitsu competitor, or were you just somebody who trained?
I've pretty much at every belt level. I just competed a few weeks ago. I wouldn't say I'm a hyper competitor. I don't need to compete every month. I like getting in there. I like compete. I'm definitely like smacking hands. I don't like losing by advantage and all that, but it is what it is. I would say I'm more on the competitive side, but I understand if you don't want to compete. I never tell my students anything like, I did it, I compete, you have to, because for a lot of people, just walking in the gym and sparring with other people, that's their competition. I definitely side toward more getting after it and going to competitions.
All right. So you don't like to win by advantages or lose by advantages, which leads me to my personal story about how bored to death I was at the Pan Ams that just happened. I went to watch my instructor dominate and look so great, which she did. And I was kind of shocked at these like high level people that I buy instructionals from, and it was hard for me to stay awake. I spent a lot of time just going back to my hotel. It's just like, how the hell do you weed that out?
I mean, to me, like the EBI, some of the rule sets that are out there from other organizations, if it's 0-0 at the end, then there's take my back, how many seconds, if I submit you or whatever it is, I think there needs to be a definite winner or loser. Because the way I look at it, if it's a 0-0 match for me and I won by an advantage, I write that up. For me, even I would write it up as a loss.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather just do submission only. I like sub only. And then I know it's hard to do with time restraints, but let's say you give each other, if a tournament's 5 minutes or 6 minutes, if there's no submission at the end of the six, okay, out. Next.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think, because I wished, in a sense, like we were at the tournament and I was like, man, it's really annoying that this is all single elimination. And instead of like when you have wrestle backs, like it's almost like the third place medal kind of, it's not that it doesn't mean anything, especially if you're in a really large bracket. But like for me, I had seven people in my bracket. Right. So if I won my first match, I would have already made it onto the podium. And to me, it's like, oh, I won one match and now I have a medal. Now I have a Pan Am's medal.
Right.
Which, granted, if I had the medal around my neck, I wouldn't feel any kind of way, but I really think that they should fight for third. And I really wish there was a different way that they went about referees' decisions in terms of like maybe some kind of overtime. Because even if it's 0-0 and it's crunch time, when you have an overtime, like whoever's the first to score or whoever scores the most points in 1 minute, that's the winner.
Right.
I think we're a little bit of ways away from that. And, when you do get into these kind of competitions where there is advantages, there's strategy in doing that. Like, I can't open all the way up and get this solid triangle, but I can shoot up a little half-ass one and
And that's what, my last competition, it was ref's decision. And we after 1 minute of head-to-head, wrestling, the ref stopped to see, he gave us like a stalling. So I'm like, okay. So I'm like, well, this guy was pretty solid on his feet. So I'm like, okay, I got to pull to get the action start. So then I pull, and to me, I went into single X, I was De La Hiva, and he was solid. I couldn't get him, right? I was trying to do everything I could. Well, right at the end, he stepped over, didn't pass, but he stepped over, the De La Hiva, on the opposite side hook. And next thing you know, match ends, and due to his step over, and I had to turn to recover, that was his reason I lost. Because I had to recover, even though he never passed, it just drives me batty.
Yeah, yeah.
I went through the match 1,000 times, and here I am, what's this match really matter to the majority? But for me, it mattered. I'm like, I did A, B, C, D. And then, but if I would have wanted to play the safe game, I could have just stayed, I could have pulled closed and the tax extra, just pull them down, just attack all day.
Yeah, yeah,
instead of opening up. But then you got to look at time restraints. The IBJJF is rolling pretty good, and you know they got the train's going down the tracks, and they probably like, hey, we're doing pretty good with no rule changes, and are packed. I mean, Masters is 98% capacity right now. It's, you know, they're going to get it 100%. I mean, so most of their events are loaded up. But Taylor, for you, I have a question, like, for your older students. So let's say you have a 70-year-old student, and they go to PANS, and they have zero people in their bracket. What do you
think? I've even faced with that right now. Like, for example, I need to get, like, 36 points in order to be eligible to fight at the World Championships.
Right.
And so I see people do this a lot where, you know, I looked up the next couple Opens that are coming up, and, like, in some of them I have one girl in the division. In some of them there's nobody signed up in my weight class. And I see people do this where, oh, I'll sign up, pay to go to this tournament. I'll get my gold medal for showing up, and then I have enough points. But for me, I'm like, man, at least there's one person in my division, win or lose, like, I got a match. You know what I mean? And I'm getting that experience. But, like, I can't justify paying to go to the Nashville Open and be the only black belt competitor female, and I win absolute in my weight, and just to get enough points to do the Worlds. Like, if I don't make it, I don't make it, you know? And at the end of the day, I see that too. Like, if there's nobody in your division, I did see that happen.
Yeah.
A woman signed up and she got her gold medal, which is like, you know, you showed up. More power to you, especially if you're in that age bracket. But, you know, I don't want to say like true competitors, but people that want to fight and are going to tournaments to fight, you know, that's why we go, is to get matches. You know, and it's happened over the years as I've gone up in belt, like blue belt and purple belt, there was always girls for me to fight. As I started to get better, like, I wouldn't have any competition in my local tournaments because I'd be the only brown belt or I'd be the only purple belt. And so I'd have to travel and go to these different places. And now black belt's a little bit deeper because there's like an end.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? There's more competition, but even still, like, one of the black belt finals matches was just one match in the rooster weight division. It was just the two girls. And it's like, man, it's like a super fight, which, man, if you're a Pan Am's gold medalist, I will never take that away from you. But, like, there's other people, like, I don't want to compare men and women because there's obviously more men in jiu-jitsu, but, like, there were black belts that had to fight 5-6 matches to make it to the finals. And, you know, that's kind of unheard of if you're in, like, wrestling or something like that, which is obviously, like, a deeper sport. But, you know, it's – everybody will look at it with their own eyes. I think it's like, I don't want to just go sign up to a tournament – where I won't have a fight just so I can get a gold medal like that. For example, I went to a tournament and there was only me and another girl in my division, and I ended up losing and I got a silver medal and I just chucked it to the side because I didn't have to. I could have gone out there and laid on the ground and still got that medal. You know, so that's just the way I look at it. You know what I mean? But I always want to get the matches, you know?
Yeah
that's what I mean. Because then I look at my, like, and I was mentioning this because I do have a couple older students, and if they do decide to compete at Masters 7 or 8, I don't think you ever get a fight.
Yeah.
A Masters 7 is
it's not deep. So my dad is 61, or he's going to be 61, and so it's like, the last time he competed was in 2016, and he went to this tournament, and the only two guys that were there were guys from our team. You know, they were affiliates from a different state, so granted, he doesn't train with them every day, but, like, he's like, dude, I don't, you know, and my dad started jiu-jitsu when he was 40, so, like, from the jump, there wasn't 40-year-old guys that were blue belts. Like, they were all black belts and brown belts, so he started off having to fight in the adult division. And not everybody can do that, right? Like, not everybody has the gas tank for that. Not everybody wants to do a 6-minute match with a 25-year-old. Like,
No.
But it's...
No mas.
Yeah, just different strokes for different folks. You know what I mean?
I guess you just learn the lapel system and then just hold them down.
Well, you know, you actually know, I kind of carry two sets of books. So when I first came back, what did I leave for, like, 3 years, I think? I left jiu-jitsu for, like, 3 years. And I actually took the burger challenge and said I was going to have several years where I ate burgers, and that 6 months turned into, I think when I left, I want to say my instructor was 16 or so. And I came back and I was like, you are an adult now. And I left at 155. I came back at 225. So,
love that.
So my thing was, I jumped right in it because my knowledge of jiu-jitsu and the system and the masters, blah, 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 I did not know. So I just signed up for Grappling Industries and I didn't know, like, oh my God, now I'm the old dude, I'm 35. And so I would just kind of look. I'd never looked at any of my opponents and I'd be like, damn, I am exhausted. Why do they still have so much energy? And a part of me was like, well, it's because you're fat now, and that's just that. And then the other part, I was like, this dude is 20 years old. This one's 22. And so all the tournaments I was going to, which I liked the way Grappling Industries did it because it was a round robin. So I was getting more matches whether I won or lost. And it was just was like I was actually getting what I showed up for. Which, because I've always done law enforcement or private security, my thing is I want to make sure the stuff that I still have in my head works on somebody into me. And so I was actually surprised I still placed in all those tournaments. A lot of them I straight out won, but I felt the difference in my age to where I didn't feel it before when I used to slap hands and go. I used to feel like I can go all day. And now it was like, I'd be in the corner and I'd hear the guy's coach yelling, he's tired. And I'd be like, who is he talking about? And I was like, oh, yeah, me. Yeah, me, I'm exhausted.
I think that's the beautiful thing, too, about jiu-jitsu, too. Like, in the gym, when you train, like, I love my young – like, at 52, I like using my technique, changing my game. Up here comes a wrestler.
Yes.
It's a challenge every class. And, you know, back to the competition, I don't want to badmouth any organization, right? It's like, IBJJF, that's their thing. Grappling Industries, that's their thing. Anybody that chooses to compete, I hope they get a match and I hope they get to compete and get in the circle. But just sometimes you're in an area where there's just not that much competition.
Yes.
Hopefully down the road, you get in a circle and you do get a bigger bracket. So I guess I didn't want to bring that up to this, that, and the other. Because I think if you do choose to compete, I hope you do get a match.
That's what I meant when I said I carry two sets of books, because I was like, there are people who will game the system. So they look at the brackets and see who's showing up, and then that's how they decide if they're going to show up. But then there's other people who are, you know, novice or hobbyists. They just sign up. They have no idea when they show up nobody's going to be there, you know.
Right.
And so I always give them 100% respect, because I'm like, you can't help it if nobody shows up. You're the modern day gladiator that showed up with your sword and your shield to fight. You can't help it if everybody else around you punked out, you know.
What do you think about this? Like, this happened, I won't name the tournament, but it happened at a tournament. So let's say you show up, I'm 200 and I'm 52, and then I pay my money, and then they're like, okay, we're going to put you with a 270.
That happens a lot here in Virginia. Maybe it's because locally, that's the only jiu-jitsu I've seen. I've always thought it was the norm. But for my age bracket now, I can see how it's unfair. Because I traveled to Maryland a few months ago to fight in one of the Nagas. And I'll be the one to call everybody out because I don't care. But I fought in the Naga. And I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to get in this division. I want to win a belt and blah, blah, blah. So I go with this one guy. He's really good. And I'm, you know, I end up having to do a lot of arm throws and lateral drops to beat him. So I'm happy I win my division. So after the fact, he comes up to me. We're talking. You know, he's very down to earth. And the guy tells me he's 65 years old. And then immediately I'm like, well, what the fuck? You know, now I feel bad for this guy. I was like, this is totally not fair. You know, you're fighting. I just looked at him because he was in such good shape. I wouldn't have thought he was, you know, 65. And I was just like, it's not fair. They put you against somebody who you were 30 years older than, you know.
And you're smashing this guy with lateral
drive. Yeah. And I felt like a total like tool. But then like the other part of me was like, well, you know, what if he gets attacked on the streets from somebody who's there? But I didn't like that feeling at all.
If it's not him, it was going to be you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
And that's kind of segueing from competition and other reasons people do jiu-jitsu, the self-defense aspect of it. Like, when I hear people, they go to schools and they don't spar them like that, you have to do situational training.
Yes.
You have to feel jiu-jitsu with a resisting opponent. You have to feel a jiu-jitsu with an aggressive person on top of you trying to, even if it's like a headlock as hard as they can, you know, because I'll put my students in situations. So, yeah, this competition side is great, and, you know, it definitely ups your game when you compete. But then, you know, even the situational training and bear hugs and headlocks and grip breaking and somebody grabs your wrist or your back of your shoulder, those are huge aspects of jiu-jitsu sometimes. The sports schools for, you know, I've been to a lot of schools too when I was traveling, and there's no such thing as, because sometimes the newer generation, you know, you listen to some of these young kids on their YouTube channels or whatever, like about the self-defense. Well, you know, that's, if you do jiu-jitsu, you're good to go anyway. You know?
And that's another thing too, is like competitive jiu-jitsu, whereas like I'll see in the higher weight classes and then a lot of male divisions and things like that, you'll see. And then also in Nogi, right? You'll see a lot more wrestling, judo, people going for takedowns, you know what I mean? Like, but then there's like the other side where we just always pull guard. Like in my division, pretty much every girl pulls guard. So I have to be savvy in that area. I have to know how to pull guard, I have to know how to pass. But in a self-defense situation, I will never, ever pull guard
if someone's
trying to attack me. You know what I mean? Like that's like how I'm going to defend myself if someone puts me on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like I will never do that. So, and then especially as like, I'm 5'3", 130 pounds. Like I'm teaching grown men jiu-jitsu and I want more girls to come to my gym, and I don't want them to think that I'm not into the self-defense aspect of it. Like I am completely, because, you know, one thing that my dad and my brother have always said is just like, just because you're good at jiu-jitsu does not mean like what if someone punches you in the face?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So I really, really try to, whenever I can, still instill like the, for example, we'll be teaching certain positions and I'm not an MMA coach by any means, but you know, I'll end up throwing in some things like, hey, if you are in this position, this is a great position to, like, this is how you're going to defend yourself with your guard. Or like, if you are on top, this is how you cause a lot of damage here, you know what I mean? Just so people get that understanding. And, you know, maybe not everyone's doing jiu-jitsu for self-defense, but for me personally as a woman, you know, I've got a weird mindset about it, I think, because I've always done jiu-jitsu, so I've always felt kind of safe. But as I've gotten older, you know, it's not hard to just bear hug me and pick me up and take me away if someone really wanted to. So I have become a little bit more aware of that, and since I've got my black belt too, I've been more like, hey, I need to become a well-rounded martial artist, not only for my gym but also for myself. Like I don't want to be feeling like if someone punched me in the face I wouldn't be able to defend myself, or I'd get knocked out cold.
Right.
You know, I'd still be able to punch somebody if I needed to, or keep somebody to keep them away from me. So that's really important to me, especially like when I start to try and bring more women in. Like the first way I'm going to get them hooked is letting them know that they're going to learn how to defend themselves. And the second way I'm going to get them hooked is like, jiu-jitsu is awesome. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, that's what I do a lot. I'll talk about like, what would you do? You know, so when I work with law enforcement, let's say, and we have a local park, Munson Park or wherever, every town's got their own park. What would you do in this scenario? Like going outside my school, there's an alley right by my school. So when you can put the student in that mindset, like, you know, cause if you just come in and you see geese and you see the blue mat, and you do a scissor sweep or hip bump sweep, that's one thing. But if you say, if you're out at Munson Park and you turn around the trail and you're knocked to the ground and somebody's in between your legs, what would you do? You know, if you get out of your car out here in the alley and somebody grabs you by the wrist, what would you do? You know, and that's when like the brake falling. And then if you do like, can you use your feet to continue to create space and time? I always say, how much time can you put on your safety clock for somebody to come help you? Because every single second counts. I don't know if that many schools talk about scenario-based training with their jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
You get knocked out from this position, like a good half guard with an underhook, right? Most people don't think the way that Damian Maia thinks, right? Damian Maia's jiu-jitsu is tight. Like, he's tight or he's space. But a lot of times you'll see a half guard with an underhook with a jaw exposed. That to me is not a good, that's not a good.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I totally agree. And I think, look, I don't know these people, but so I have this thing sometimes where I think worst case scenario, best case scenario. Worst case scenario, they have learned how to do things a certain way and they teach it a certain way and they don't like an outsider coming in and saying that's impractical. But I have done law enforcement since I was 19 years old. So I already come in with that blinder on. Even when I'm learning a technique that I 100% like, my brain's already filtering out, this is for competition, this is for the day I take somebody down. And a lot of the times, I'm 5'7". My whole real Federal Protective Services career and military police officer career, I was like 130, 140 pounds. Normally, I was the one initiating the takedown because I knew I'm the shortest person. I don't really have time to wrestle with these people. I focused on what we used to call in blind law enforcement, ask, tell, make. Sir, would you step out of the vehicle? Sir, get out of the vehicle. And the next thing you know, I'm snatching you through the window. And it was funny because I was so small. They'd be like, oh, my God, Daryl's so aggressive. I'm like, no. I don't have time to play around with these people. Once I get them in cuffs, I can de-escalate very quickly because everything's done. So there's a lot of techniques that when I look at jiu-jitsu, I think you are teaching people how to compete, not how to survive in an actual altercation. And I even saw it when I would look at some combat training things we would do out here at Camp Allen, where they would do jiu-jitsu, but they give you a blue knife. And the guy would just be sitting there like, stab, 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 stab. And I was like, I have to figure out some others. I have to make this thing work, you know, to fight like literally my life depends on it. So it's actually because I approach it from that aspect. When I do competitions, I am never nervous because I know I'm having fun. I already know, like, yeah, in your gi, you don't have a knife or a billy club or pepper spray. At the end of the day, I'm going to walk home. Even if I go home with a broken finger, all right, I'm going home today. You know, and so it's I literally am doing that to teach myself, this is what your body does in this position now. You've gotten older. You can't just blast double everybody and just shin dive at the whole world. And you know, and so it's like, well, that's kind of why I started playing bottom half when I had my groin injury. I was like, yeah. I used to be able to just pick everybody up and throw everyone and do all this stuff. And I was like, I have to be able to learn something else, which for handcuffing, it's normally wrist. I'm always, even though there's a lot of material to grab, I'm always looking for the wrist. And I'm like, I'm getting your wrist, I'm getting your fingers to put you in handcuffs. You know, and every a lot of the other part of the body, I really do ignore. You know, like leg locks are cool. Well, I can't do that on the force. It's just I'm not allowed. And I'm not going to jump on the ground with my gun belt and try to leg lock somebody and somehow figure out how to get up to your body to get you in handcuffs. It's just not going to happen that way. And so luckily for at least me, I think I was just blessed that my instructor, my main instructor, was an ex-Marine who kind of thought that way and like a former boxer. So we would have his jiu-jitsu classes, but he'd also have a guy that would come in and he'd have fake guns and knives and we'd be sprinting at each other. And it was literally, I may piss my pants, but I want to learn this here. So when I'm out on the streets, I know exactly how I react. And and then I train to that, you know, to get better. And, you know, maybe I panic and then I know all the moves. But a panic on the street can cost me my life, you know. And so I think that that's where jiu-jitsu, especially where it started, I kind of agree with some of the early founders who didn't care about the sport aspect of it. They saw it as this is supposed to be a defense thing where a smaller person learns how to defend themselves against a bigger bully. And so it's like I find myself going back to that, like, yeah, I love to compete, but I'm like, I'm doing it for a defense tactic, you know, like.
That's another really important thing too. I think like one thing I wanted to touch on when you were talking about leg locks, like in jiu-jitsu, leg locks have, they've always been around, but they've definitely become more pronounced over the past few years. And then people believe in their jiu-jitsu so much that when you see them applied in MMA, you see a lot of failed attempts at them because someone can punch you in the face now. You have two hands on a leg. You have zero hands to defend your face, right? And then on the other aspect, what you just said, like jiu-jitsu is designed to be for a smaller person to be able to defend themselves against a bigger attacker, right? But that stops when you are a smaller person being attacked by someone that knows anything about grappling. Like, I felt like I always kind of had that in me, like, oh yeah, if someone attacked me, I'd be okay. I know so much jiu-jitsu. But like, what if a blue belt, some big blue belt came to kidnap me or something? Like, I'm not gonna, in a life or death situation, I'm not gonna win that, you know? And so I think that that's just really important for people to grasp, especially people that are really great at jiu-jitsu. Like, you know, or just even when you were talking about your blue belt guys and a wrestler comes in and, you know, they're getting taken down over and over and over, and the guy's just pinning them, like in a really solid pinning position. You can't get off any of your moves.
Yeah, yeah. So
there's obviously a lot of nuances in there, but, you know, while jiu-jitsu is so amazing, it's not the end-all be-all, and there's a lot of the important core values of jiu-jitsu, like defending yourself and being able to protect yourself, that sometimes get lost in translation, depending on where you train, or who your instructor is, or even like what your goals are in jiu-jitsu.
So as two professors, how did you guys weed that out or kind of add both in it for your competitors versus your practical, I want to teach you how to defend yourself in this crazy ass world, you know?
Well, I mean, we do competition classes, you know, so we'll have some competition classes. I'll split the mat, you know, sometimes if we're getting ready for one of our tournaments, I'll split, you know, I'll say self-defense left, self-defense jiu-jitsu left, and then competition right. So I'll split them up once in a while. But I'm more old school, I'd say self-defense based. You know, again, what Taylor was saying, most of the positions that I'll put, like today I taught, you know, from the top position, Kimura top. So let's say I pass the guard, then I get side pin. From side pin, they try to win the underhook, so I pin the wrist, right? What you talked about, the wrist, you sweep to north-south to get to Kimura trap. From there, you have scissor necks on both sides, which is old school, right? You can fall left, take the neck, fall right, take the neck. But I'm always saying, you know, I'll remind them of a scenario. That, you know, if this happens out there, can this work, you know, or can it work? You know, and a majority of the time when I'm teaching, it's going to help you in a street situation, you know? But if we're focusing on a point tournament, then we'll do like a circle up and I'll say, let's cover these rules because this rule set's different. Let's cover the scoring because this is different. And I got to do that as a coach because I screwed up a couple times as a coach. I didn't read all the rules. I didn't know, like in the kids program, you can't do a standing guillotine.
That is so annoying. The kids disqualified for that. And I was
and he was crying. Like, I felt horrible as a coach because the ref raised my kid's hand up. So he didn't know.
It's good jiu-jitsu.
It's self-defense. So, you know, and back to the self-defense, like with my kids' program, tackle defense, punch defense, hug defense, mount escapes, headlock escapes, grip breaking. Somebody trick kick. We do, I hate to say it, but we do like a kidnapping game where I'll try to grab.
Man, I love it. I love it.
We do the same thing.
Yeah. Like, I'm chasing on the kids. Here I am, like, you know, and I'm trying to grab them. But at the tournament, so, like, that's where I asked, I'm like, the ref said that he won, and then some of the coach saw that, and you can't do Ezekiel chokes, nothing across the trach, you know, sometimes. Going to the trach, but I mean, is a competitive side to answer your question, as a coach and a school owner, you got to split it, you know, to talk about rules and points. And then over here, which I think the focus should be, is keeping you safe if you ever ended up in a really bad situation out in the street, you know. And again, to your point, Taylor, I would say you, though, as a black belt with your years of training, you know, you talk about the big blue belt. I still give you way more time in your safety clock.
100%.
That's what I'm talking about. Like, I would, like, that's the mindset, too. Like, the mindset. If somebody grabbed my daughters, you know, the 24, 21, they don't, I would say we're black belts. But they're not, you know, but they trained me a little bit. But I think the tools that I gave them, you know, the situational awareness, being loud if somebody puts eye contact, not being, you know, talking about safety. Not enough people have those talks at their kitchen table
with
their family because they think it's never going to happen to them.
Exactly.
But it does happen. It happens everywhere. You know, so I don't, it's like, it's a topic that, no, that's too scary to talk about with my kid.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in my kid's class, I talk about kidnapping. I talk about people being pushed, you know, the bully stuff. And those are the, that's the dialogue that should be happening in a responsible way at a jiu-jitsu school. Because I think us as school owners and as upper belts, that's our responsibility, because it is such a great art. But you can't just say it's all about winning a medal. It's way more than just points advantage.
That's the whole point of martial arts. You know what I mean? So like you'll get, you know, I get a lot of times kids that come from like karate or taekwondo backgrounds, and it's like that has always been sold as a self-defense method, which like obviously there are things in there that are self-defense. But you know, what happens when a little kid that wrestles takes you down on the ground and your karate doesn't work there, you know? So And I do the same thing. Like some of the parents were laughing at me when I was doing, you know, we did like, I try to do this whenever we get like a big group of new kids in, like we'll do a specific day where we're just doing self-defense, you know, like in a way that it translates to jiu-jitsu as well. But also like I bring up the scary stuff because God, how, you know, you never think it's going to happen to you. And like me as a coach, if I'm not showing that to my kids, how would I feel knowing what I know,
if I
don't regurgitate this to my students, especially the kids, you know, and I do the same thing. That's what my dad always taught me. Like, we pick each other up and it's like, all right, you got to get out. Like, what are you going to do here? And it's the little kids are laughing and it's funny. And I'm like, I do have a serious talk. I'm like, hey, this is why we do this, because, you know, do your mom and dad ever talk about strangers? Like, don't go hang out with strangers. I was like, sometimes strangers will come up to you and they seem really nice, blah, 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 getting into that. And then obviously it's a kid's class, so I have to have a level of fun in there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're not coming here to get scared straight.
Yeah.
But, you know, I preface with like, this is serious and this is why we do this. So that way bad things don't happen to us.
Yeah.
Or if something bad does happen to you, you know, you're leaving there with the least amount of damage possible. Or like you said, the safety clock, you know, you've been able to hold off someone. Yeah, like kidnapping you until someone can hear you and come get you, and you know.
Yeah,
that's something really important to me, especially as a woman. I don't want, I get that like mom vibe with my kids, and then also for me, I want everyone around me to be safe and feel okay to walk across the street at night. Like, depending on where you are.
And see, and I think your point is like when I do these presentations on the road for the Run Safer, I like to, you know, I research articles in that specific area or bring up examples around the country. And one that I always bring up is a situation in Seattle where a jogger was out for her. She was training for a marathon and she went into a restroom at like the 4 or 5 mile mark of this trail that she used to run. Well, somebody targeted her knowing they had seen her there before. They waited for her in the bathroom and started to attack her. Well, she had some self-defense training. She fought. It was like an over 3 or 4 minute fight that she had to fight this guy. Well, you know, and she just kept fighting. She kept fighting. And when I talk about the mindset with training, knowing I can get another second, I know I can fight for another second. I know that comes with showing up and training. If you don't train or you think it's never going to happen to you. And again, I always tell my audiences, I don't want to scare you. I don't want to get you paranoid that every time you go out for a walk, there's a creepy person that's going to grab you. The chances are very slim, but don't you want to be prepared just in case?
Exactly.
And to me, I love all martial arts, but I love jiu-jitsu. And I think jiu-jitsu for the overall, if it's a great school that's teaching you what you should be taught, jiu-jitsu to me is the best art. I like Western boxing. I love wrestling. But for jiu-jitsu, I think jiu-jitsu is the one that I would pick first.
Yeah.
If I could choke you out and leave you on the street, I've got white belts that can do that. You know what I mean? I got white belts that can
do that. Even if it's a re-grip to an arm drag so you can run. Like an arm drag. Somebody grabs me by the shoulder, inside arm drag, I run. You know, those are huge techniques where you're never even engaging. You're getting rid of the engagement so you can get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I am going to kind of play this little game. No. I because here's the thing. I do this as well. I was raised by a majority of all women. I was raised by my granddad. My dad unfortunately died 3 or 4 months before I was born. So because my whole family came from a law enforcement background, my granddad was the warden of the prison, so I would really couldn't get in a lot of trouble growing up. So I've always looked at the women in my family like, and it sucks to say this, like potential victims, because I've never trusted people around them. You know, I've never trusted, you know, I've always just, because I was always into law enforcement, I always just saw bad, bad, bad all day long. So I really had this sense to where you have to learn some way to protect yourself. But I also realized over time that most people who attack people are cowards. And when they realize you're going to fight back, they will flee, you know. So having some tools in your toolbox is better than having no tools at all. So it was like I started off with Taekwondo, and, you know, that's how I got into martial arts. We had a Taekwondo instructor at the YMCA. My granddad was a boxer, so he would teach us a little bit of boxing combinations. And then one day, you know, I started wrestling very young, I think around 9 or 8. And so, but I still used to like these fancy little leg kicks, and I'd be like, yeah, I'm just going to kick him in the face. And then one day somebody said, yeah, Taekwondo doesn't work on the ground. And it made me like, oh yeah, I probably have to learn something else. And it was just really in my life, I have been able to take people down and hold them and not hurt them. There was a drunk guy when I was in Korea, you know. The culture is just very different. He was beating on his girlfriend right there in the middle of the bar. And I was like, my nature wanted to just get up and beat the shit out of him. But I was like, I will literally cause an international incident if I do this. You know, and I'm in the military. Not only that, I was shore patrol as a military police officer. This is going to be a big deal. So I was literally able to... He did some little kick towards me when he saw me coming. I grabbed his leg. I swept him for an inside trip. And I just fucking, what we now call a gift wrap. And I just held him there and just stared at him. Like, yeah, all those little kicks aren't going to work. And the Korean police came with they don't carry guns in South Korea. And they just came. And it was amazing to see. They were taking this guy down with judo and jiu-jitsu throws. And I was just like, wow, they don't have guns, but they knew all those techniques. And I was like, even here, I can see that this stuff works. And so it became this little thing where I would have my friends over, the majority of women, and I would teach them like certain mechanisms. And I would say, now this is what you don't do in class, but this is how you kind of kill somebody. And I was like, this is not a joke. And I was like, but you get somebody in your guard, this is what a down elbow is, and this is where you hit them. And I was like, this is jiu-jitsu, and that's great when you're in class, but if somebody's attacking you, I'm not the guy telling you to pull out your rape whistle. I'm the guy telling you these are down elbows, these are the strikes that's going to make him be like, I don't want anything to do with this. You're like, you damn right. And when the police do show up, which the police response time is usually about 5 minutes, you know, a lot of things can happen in that 5 minutes. And police try their damnedest to do a lot of things, but... they're not Batman. They're not Superman. You know, you have to get on the phone. The dispatcher has to dispatch them out. If you're in the middle of nowhere, a state trooper sometimes can be the only trooper in the entire city for that night patrol. And it's going to take a while for him to get to you. So you have to know whatever it takes to be like, okay, I do know some kicks, but just in case I'm in the terrain and not on the mat and I slip and fall, I need to know what happens when he goes to punch. You know, and so I always say I have my jiu-jitsu is good for you thing, but I also know, well, I know some girls that know some combination punches, and the last time this guy got in a fight, he was in middle school, and he thinks he can fight, right up until she throws her hands up and knocks his damn clock off, and he's like, I don't want it. All of a sudden, I'm thinking about what I wanted to do, because at the end of the day, bullies, like terrorists and rapists, they go for weak targets. You know what I mean? And they're not going to target somebody who they think is going to give them a major amount of pushback. So that's why I say, like, whatever tools in your toolbox you can get, I'm pro jiu-jitsu, I'm pro taekwondo, I'm pro boxing, I'm pro Muay Thai, clinching with some knees. And I'm like in all the bad spots, the throat, the nuts, the kneecaps, everything you can get. I'm pro teaching women how to shoot, you know, and it's just like, I'm training you to do these things as I'm praying you never have to use them.
Yeah.
You know,
that's it. And then I think it's so important. Like, you know, when you think about the belt system and to me, you have to train for life.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when I do these seminars, that's one of the first things I say. It's like, guys, I'm dropping a seed in there and it's got to grow. If I'm just giving you what an introduction to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is and I'll take an assistant, you know, I'll show some things, but I'm not one of those guys. It's like, hey, you're good after today.
Yeah.
If I'm in San Diego, I'm like, here's a school you need to go visit. This is where you need this, you know, check out these schools, make it your home and start to train consistently. If it's Jiu-Jitsu, if it's striking, if it's whatever it is, it can't just be 1 month and then you are magically be ready to go.
I agree.
It's trained for life. And, you know, I like white, blue, you know, blue, brown, you know, purple. But it's still, even when you get third degree, I'm still never going to stop training.
Correct. I think
I don't know if that's the majority of people. Majority of people want, like, I got my blue belt, I'm good. No, I'm like, you just got to keep coming. You know, and I don't even care. If you leave me and go to another school, just keep training. Keep training forever.
A statement and then a question. So I 100% agree. You have to train. We used to have these little notions in the military, these sayings, and they said you train like you fight, you fight like you train. And so it was just, sadly, I would see so many of my friends, would get put in these bad situations where they would get stabbed or, you know, they get shot or they get pepper sprayed. And a lot of them lived and a lot of them, you know, my last year in the military, I literally listened to one of my best friends, one of the greatest people I knew. We survived the Middle East together. He came back right here to Norfolk, Virginia, and I had to listen to him die over the radio. And he was the watch commander at Naval Ordnance Base, and he was the chief of the guard at Naval Ordnance Base, and I was the watch commander at NSA Hampton Roads. Somebody, a trucker, high on bath salts, who literally was normally every single day, he worked on the base, came normal, got high, his semi ran the gate, did the MAs, you know, nighttime, they weren't paying a lot of attention, tried to raise the bollards, he got through the bollards, got all the way down to the pier of the ship before he was challenged, and he was challenged by a female who was not properly trained because she wasn't an MA. She wasn't a military police officer. She wasn't a master at arms. She was actually a storekeep who trained on a gun once a year. And she saw that this guy had no business being there. She did everything she could do to stop him and got to where she had to pull out her gun, pull out her Beretta, pointed it at him. And one shitty thing about those old military Berettas, they're heavy and they have safety mechanisms. She pulled that trigger. It did not shoot him, and she literally, I saw it on the camera, and they had the extra report. She took the gun and put it to her face to figure out what the hell was going on with it, and he snatched it out of her hand, and he knew where the safety was. And my friend Mark Mayo jumped on top of her, and he shot through him trying to kill the girl. And then the Overwatch with the M16s ended up killing him. The female lived, and the only person that died was the trucker who broke on base, you know, and my friend. And I kept thinking, like, Jesus, you know, like, this girl has to suffer for the rest of her life thinking she did something wrong, when in all actuality, the Navy set her up for failure. You know, it was somebody that she literally shoots one time a year. And I mean, they hand him the gun. They shoot three rounds. They don't teach him anything about fundamentals. And now my friend is dead.
Right.
You know, it's his family got $400,000 check plus $50,000 SGLI, but I guarantee you they'd rather have, you know, Mark Mayo alive.
Oh, for sure. And that's, you know, when you talk about training law enforcement, you know, even a local in Monroe with the county and the city and some of the local state at the state post, it's like mount escape, punch defense, clinching. You don't have to give a lot. That's what I tell the officers. If you're going to come here, we can do a mount escape every time you come here with me throwing strikes down at you. And that's what we're going to do. And the next time you come, guess what we're going to do? Mount escape with me throwing strikes down at you. What are we going to do the next time? Mount escape with me throwing strikes. Because you're only coming this much, so I'm not going to give you I'm going to give you what you're going to remember. I'm not going to give you mount escape for 10 minutes, punch defense to clinch for 10 minutes, a grip release for 10 minutes. Because it's not, you know, let's just zone in on one thing that's going to stick if you're not going to train here consistent. And even then, I it's still not enough time. You keep coming. But that's what I'm trying to do with law enforcement now, because if we had 100 officers, maybe 10 are training consistent, you know, in the gym, and the other ones will come once in a while. That, you know, so you break it down into situations where they can, I'm like, mount escape, or, you know, you're faced this way, next thing you know, here comes an overhand right, clench, disengage, be able to access. Over and over.
So what made you, or how did you get into the law enforcement training at Monroe?
So growing up in Monroe, again, I mentioned it started like a super small town. So the police chief, Charles McCormick, is my good friend. And so my gym is, maybe I can throw a stone to the police, you know, police department. So he came in and I showed him what I was doing. And I said, look, I've worked with officers down in Jacksonville. Here's the things that we can put together. Any officer from anywhere is allowed to train for free in my school forever. So I don't, there's no fee. They can train. But like I tell them, you got to train consistent. You got to show up. We try to start at 2 hours per quarter mandatory, but now the officers are so stretched with overtime and everything that's been going on since the pandemic, they barely have enough time to tie their shoes because they're working 12 or 18s.
Yeah.
You know, so, but they also, I think training is a you know, I message and I call them like, look, it's here for you. I usually send them either a monthly or biweekly reminder, like, here's what we're doing. You're always welcome. Please come. Because I want them to train.
Yeah.
We do the same thing in our gym. And, you know, with that, because at the end of the day, like you were saying, you know, the girl only shoots once a year. Like a lot of these law enforcement officers only get like combatives training when they're in the academy, or like every once in a while someone will come into a seminar for them. But it's one of those things, like, you have to train for life, you know. And I understand that this is a job that some days, if you are getting a lot of action, I don't want to go train at jiu-jitsu and be put in these situations. It's, you know, regular everyday average people don't really want to do that, you know. So we have always offered free training for law enforcement just because of that reason. Like, you know, all these things where, you know, people get hurt from excessive force. And it's in a lot of situations, I don't think it comes from like malice. It just comes from like if this guy was a blue belt in jiu-jitsu, he would know when he's cranking this kimura, he's going to rip this guy's shoulder out. Or if you, you know, cover someone's carotid arteries for too long, like they will lose blood supply to their brain. Like it's just, you know, so those are really important things to be training all the time, even if it is just the most basic thing, like mount escape. That's a really great one. That's like a terrible worst case scenario for a law enforcement officer.
Yeah.
So if you just know how to get out of there, you can be confident, like, okay, I know enough when we're standing on the feet, I'll be okay. If worst case scenario, someone puts me on my back and his knees over me, I'm going to be able to get out. Or I feel confident I've done this enough, I'm going to at least be able to like de-escalate a situation or get out okay. So I think that's really, really important. And I think that's something that like people that don't do jiu-jitsu, they don't understand as well. It's just like, they're not superheroes. Like they're doing a really hard job that not a lot of people want to do. Especially like in the recent, you know, past, it's like, you know, a lot of people don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, just here in Norfolk where I live, we're having like, we're down, like they're offering bonuses for people because we don't have enough officers, like not enough people want to do it. But it is cool where we live. The guy that runs the combatives part of the police academy, he is a black belt in jiu-jitsu, which I think is really important.
Nice.
And that's a really great asset to have. And he'll even tell people like, hey, go do jiu-jitsu, or we'll even have people come in that like they didn't get accepted into the police academy. And so people will be like, okay, hey, go do jiu-jitsu first. Like, especially like smaller guys that they're like, or women and stuff, send them to jiu-jitsu. Go to the Norfolk gym down here. They'll let you for free.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes when we offer free things, people don't see the value in it, you know? So I'll even be like, hey, I'll slash the price in half if it helps you go because you're paying, you know, but that's something that's like kind of near and dear to my heart, because I want, you know, I don't want police officers to be scared.
Yeah.
I want them to feel, you know, confident that they're going to be okay.
Well, it's one of those things as like, I've always worked for either the state or the federal government, and I've always had one job. Either I've been a federal police officer of some type, or I've been working contracts in private security and for the state or for the feds. Like right now, the contract I work, well, it's protecting Navy vessels. So it's literally, I'm just sitting around with a bunch of MAs all day, and I'm like, oh, you guys can't get in trouble. I'll go out there and I'll do the stuff, you know? So the way that we are trained is in a mechanism where you kind of are always scared, but that's just because somebody always just got killed. You know, even if it's not in your department, an officer somewhere is getting shot, you know, all the time. And even though everybody else doesn't know about it, we know. We get those be on the lookouts all the time. And when I was going through to the academy years ago, one thing they would always used to drill into our head was, I'm going home today. I'm going home. I'm going home. I'm going home. And so I used to tell people, there is no such thing as a routine traffic stop. It's the most dangerous part of the job. And it's just like, when you get out of the academy sometimes, because the funding in certain states is so bad, if you're not paying to put, you know, keep training, you're really only doing your annual training for your gun shoot, and that's kind of it, you know. And it sucks where I say, like with that young lady where I say she was set up for failure, police are kind of in that same boat, because it's a job that nobody wants to do because it's a thankless job. And so they are overworked, and by the very nature of the way state funding works, they're underfunded. And everybody, you know, I used to joke with some of my cop friends, and they'd be like, oh, when are you going to come to the police force? And I used to say, you know, when I was in the military, if I was the biggest bag of ass in my unit, when people saw me in that uniform, they'd be like, oh, thank you for your service. Oh, just an amazing. I was like, but when you see police, that's just not what people think. And that's a bad thing. You know, people are either afraid of cops, or they get pulled over for speeding that they were doing. And they're just like, what the fuck you pulling me over for? There's people out here, and I don't think people recognize that police on a daily basis are not dealing with the best people in society. They're dealing with the worst of the worst of the worst. They're getting spit on every day. You know, they're underpaid, they're underfunded, they're not supported by a large part of the public, and most of what the media, which is a whole bunch of curse words come to my head, and my grandma's listening, so I'm not going to do that. But the media has this thing where they hyper-focus on the mishap or the bad shot without explaining the context of, all right, there's 170 people in that department that didn't do this today.
Right.
You know.
And times that by all the departments in the country.
Yeah.
And then that's what we were talking yesterday. It's like, you know, there's bad people. You know, there are bad people, and then, but they focus, the media focuses on, they don't focus on the 99% of people that are good people.
Yeah.
They focus on that 0.5, and then everybody thinks that everybody's like that. Just like the division in this country, it's not like what the media, there's more people that are together.
Yeah.
But the media focuses on that division. They're trying their best.
Yeah.
Doing a pretty good job. I got rid of all social media and all news. I just go to my school and I help as many people as possible. And I come back and I go back again and I come back and I go see my mom and I come back and I call my kids and I tell them I love them. And that's what I do.
Well, you know what's funny? Speaking of like the media, I'm not going to rabbit trail us too much, but it was like last year when they had the defund the police thing. You know, and that was like a big thing, and I was looking and I was, you know, trying to see, and you know, I have yet to meet anybody personally who actually wants to defund the police ever. And I talk for a living, you know, not one black, white, red, Native American. They're like, oh, hell no. You know, they got a bunch of crazy people that they feel like, no, I want more police. You know, right. I actually just want them to be better paid and more trained, and I actually want them to look more like me. And I'm like, oh, yeah, cool. But that's all you heard all right. last year, all summer. Yeah. You know, defund this. I was like, yeah. And then who are you gonna call when you get attacked again?
Right.
You know, yeah. Ghostbusters.
Yeah. But this back conversation, it's just the media. To me, the media is just. I just got sick of it. I feel like if everybody in a micro level can help their communities out, can be nice to. And I know this cliche, but be nice to one another. You know, I was talking to my kids' class yesterday about bullying and stuff. I'm like, help one another. Don't say anything negative. Say something positive. Keep your mouth shut if you're going to be negative. Somebody can't throw or somebody can't do something. And this is how I'm breaking it down in my class. I'm like, if you look over and you see Jim over there and he's not getting it right, is it nice to laugh at him? And the kids are like, well, no. I'm like, well, some of you guys are laughing. Like I said, that. You don't need to do that. You know, you just be positive. Help Jim out. Go over there and help him get the throw down, you know?
Yes.
In the bigger picture with our communities, it's the same thing. Instead of jumping on the negative bandwagon, be nice. Do something nice today. Wake up every day and have a little post-it, three things that you can do. Maybe make a phone call to somebody and see how they're doing that you haven't talked to in a while. Number two, do something in your community with volunteer time or give clothes away or something. All of us can do something instead of riding this negative division train that they're trying to pull on us in the media.
So I got a question for you both on that front. How do you guys as professors weed out bad apples or negative Nancys or gym cancers out of your gyms?
Go ahead, Jim.
So for the most part, my gym, like my dad started my gym, my brother is a part of our gym. And I'm a part of the gym. So at the very top of the pyramid of our gym is a family. And I think, you know, I don't have a really huge mat space. It's kind of small. We don't have more than 100 students or anything. So just the core values of our gym are there, and we are a family, and we're always trying to lift each other up. So in that sense, a lot of the people that aren't going to get down and vibe with like what we're doing there, they kind of weed themselves out. Mm-hmm. On the level above that, where like, you know, some people just have very terrible social cues or just aren't really getting the memo or are just shitty people in general. You know, I try to talk to them and be like, hey, like, are you okay? Is everything fine? Is that because sometimes people just shitty people, it's not what's wrong with people that are around them that they're being mean to, you know, it's something wrong with them. Mm-hmm. So really just starting the conversation usually helps. And then if it goes beyond something else where it's that bad, I haven't had to do this in my time. I'm sure my dad has, but you know, if it gets further than that, it's like, hey, maybe you should just take some time off from the gym. And then if it's, you know, even beyond that, like, hey, I don't think this is a good fit for you, you know? So okay. I think that the culture at our gym is one that, if you don't really get the memo, you're going to start to, or like, even, you know, I'm kind of like everyone's little sister at the gym. So
yeah.
when something's happening or, you know, people are going to protect everyone. Like there's, yeah. I hate to say that there's like mat enforcers, but like if someone's being, if someone's being an asshole, like,
oh, I got to edit that out now.
If someone's being an asshole, you know, it usually gets addressed. And granted, I don't want people to beat each other up, but like, you know, I just try to breed a really good culture that we're all lifting each other up, all helping each other out. The biggest thing I have to do is with the kids. Like, hey, yeah, like don't laugh at somebody because they're not doing it right. Do you remember when you first came in here and you didn't know how to forward roll?
Exactly. And you know,
that's what I tell all of them. That's, nobody knew how to do this before they got here.
That's such a good thing. I want Todd to answer the same question, but before I forget, because I'm scatterbrained, that mat enforcer thing, I think, is just a beautiful position that I have appointed myself as a resident purple belt who should be a brown belt or a black belt already. Because and I see it. I think it's because I've always been able to handcuff people and do all these things. And it's like, I remember years ago we had a judo guy come in and he was just dominating everybody. And I was like, oh, well, I did a little bit of college wrestling and he seems like a dick. That is not going to work on me. And I was a white belt then. And I remember I just was taking this guy down at will. And I was studying everything he did. And I liked the judo. He actually made me really like judo. But that particular guy announced his throws. So I'd be like, yeah, when I see him exhale, I'm going to blast double him so hard. And so it was funny because yesterday I realized, you know, and I'm 36 now. I was like, I still do that. Taylor was rolling with one of our white belts who's very strong. And she was getting, you know, exhausted, which she'll do. And she's the smallest one at the gym. And I saw him get a rear naked choke. And when she tapped, in my head, I wanted to be like, oh, great, he's learning. I immediately got pissed. Stop. And I just came
it
off
was
the.
Okay.
And yeah, and
yourself to that.
And I thought about it like when I was driving home. I came off the wall and I just immediately just beat the next four people I wrestled to show them like, yeah, well, I'm a purple belt and I can still beat you up and that's that and that's my instructor. Don't ever choke her again. And as I was driving home, I was like, oh, you know, Aiden's getting really good. He got Taylor today, and I should be happy about that. Because he had a really good attitude about it. And so when I was going outside, Austin said it. Austin was like, yeah, Daryl's going to sit and observe everything. And the second Taylor starts losing, he's like, hoo, 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 hoo. And I said, I did do that, didn't I? So the same question is for Utah. How do you weed out the gym cancers or the toxic people out of your gym?
You know, similar to Taylor, I mean, this is our fifth year, and as you were talking, I was thinking about the question. I've been fortunate. You know, we haven't had, I think the ones that come in, they don't know much about jiu-jitsu, they weed themselves out. It's like, I do a pretty good warm-up. I work really hard with push-ups and crunches and jiu-jitsu-specific movement. If they're not, you know, at the beginners, you know, I'll back off a little bit until they get in there, but you know, I did get a couple people from other gyms that I could see were going pretty hard, you know, but they're not coming back. But like, if a new guy came in this week and I see him maybe as a four stripe white belt and he's holding on to arm bars longer than he should, or he's, you know, really being rough with maybe my older students, well, I would pull him aside and say, look, we don't do things this way. You know, we're here to help each other. We're not here to hurt each other. If we don't have, you know, training partners, nobody gets better. So that's usually how I preface it. Almost once a week, I'll have the talk in front of the morning class and the evening class about guys, we need to tap, we need to do this, these are the things, this is what you should do with your training partners. So I'll have that dialogue so they know my expectations. So if they do go outside that sort of, you know, outside those rules and kind of the guidelines that I've set, then they know they're going to have a talk with me.
Okay. Now this is just coincidental. The head instructor of our school, of our lineage, is Gustavo Machado. And he literally posted this a few hours ago and ties into what we were saying. He posted it this morning and it just says, if you see someone falling behind, walk beside them. If you see someone being ignored, find a way to include them. Always remind people of their worth. One small act could mean the world to them. And it's just one of those things, like, I think so much of him, because even though I actually don't go to his main academy, he's in Virginia Beach, and I started off with Professor Mark Saucer, and so I've always stuck with Mark. I like his rough and tumble, quick trick style, and you know, I kind of like him, and he's, you know, there's other affiliates that are actually closer to where I stay, and I've always started with Mark, and I just want to be with Mark till I get my black belt or blah blah blah. So, but I've seen, like, Gustavo is just such a gentle spirit. You know, I've seen where we had a deaf guy that does jiu-jitsu at our gym. And when he came for his seminar, you know, he was trying to teach this kid. And my professor, Mark Saucer, said, Gustavo, he's deaf. And Gustavo never said a word, never acknowledged it. And for the entire portion of the seminar, he focused in on that kid to make sure he could see all the moves. And those little practical examples where I'm like, he didn't give a speech, he didn't say anything, but I saw the way he's one of the best in the world to do it. If he can be that nice and not be a dick, then I shouldn't have to be an asshole either. You know what I mean? If I have to be mean to compete, I'm probably not that good.
Right.
You know what I mean? And there's nuance there because I want to win. But I don't hate my opponent, you know, and I don't hate my teammates. I actually need them to be tough and to train. And a lot of guys, because of the nature of my job, when we do stuff. I tell them, oh yeah, you can. I'm the guy you can roll hard. And they'll be like, really? And I say, yeah, you can do the shoulder of justice. You can crank my neck. And I said, because I'm doing it for a different reason. You know, and I said, and most of the time I have a, most of the time I'm actually not doing much attacking. I'm doing a lot of defending because in law enforcement, I was taught do things as if CNN is watching. So a lot of the times I'm letting you attack me first so I can respond appropriately, you know, and so...
Yeah. Don't you think the more you do jujitsu and the more you in combat sports, the more experience you have, the less rough you have to be.
It's yes.
Like,
yes.
I was telling you this yesterday. I feel like, you know, my students say, coach, it doesn't look like you're doing anything. It just looks like you're laying there. I'm like, coach is a snapping turtle. coach is an old snapping turtle. And if you get, I'm waiting and I'm going to wait and I might put you, you're going to be my half guard. And then if I see it, I mean, I'm looking for the sweep, or I'm going to stay, or I'm going to submission. But I want to change my logo to an old snapping turtle with a gi in it.
what's your logo now?
Just a side note. My dad nice. Is listening, and he is laughing because that's literally how he rolls.
Yeah.
Like, he'll still slap hands with me, and I'm trying to move all fast and do all this competition stuff, and he's like, just letting me do it. And then whenever it's ready, like arm triangle, I'm like,
yeah.
Dad, every time.
That's so great because I like Eddie Bravo and I like John Jock Machado, and I once heard Eddie Bravo say he has never been able to catch John Jock, and I'm like, and I have never been able to catch Mark in a damn thing. no, when I was jacked and buff and never. He's just like, yeah, whatever, man. I may be able to get a nice takedown, but I know there's going to be a nice choke coming, right?
and you look at it like too, like for longevity rolling. It's like I hurt my neck in 06, really, you know, we're doing King of the Mat and takedown. The guy had my chin, and I thought the drill was over because his butt was about to hit the mat. But then I stopped resisting, and he twisted my chin and pretty much, you know, was trying to break my neck. So my arm went numb. I had articulations. I had a C5, C6 impingement in my spine. So it was one of those that a lot of us go through bad necks, right?
Wow.
But I remember an orthopedic surgeon told me, he's like, you know, you might have to retire. And I'm like, that's, you know, quit jujitsu or retire. I'm not, you know, I was like, I'm not going to. And he goes, well, how about a fusion? I go, I'll just rehab and do traction. But from that point forward, my game changed into kind of the snapping turtle. Because I'm like, I know I loved it so much within the first 4 years that I knew it was something I wanted to do until I was 100. Mm-hmm. So from that point forward, I made the half guard. Like if we rolled, I can even tell you right now, you may think I'm doing a takedown. I'm not. I'm pulling you right in my half guard.
So is so that
people look at my ears and they're like, oh, he's got to be like a takedown guy. Nope.
Not
a
takedown guy.
Just from keeping the ear close to the chest and half guard.
Yeah. So your surgery, is that what made you so good at your? Because I know you're known for bottom half. Is that what made you start to do your bottom half a lot?
Well, I didn't have the surgery. I did traction and I did ART and I did a lot of rehab to get the separation from the disc. So
okay.
I never did. But that is what made. Yeah, that's what started my half guard. And Seneca was a huge Seneca. Was a Hall of Famer half guard guy. So he was a smaller 155. Pedro was a smaller, my second instructor. So I learned from a smaller side of the game. And, you know, I tried to study every way possible from knee, you know, and countering, getting tapped different, you know, knowing where the counters to that counter. I study half guard nonstop. But now I am going down that rabbit hole of lapel guard.
So, It's actually pretty cool. Our instructor is Gordo. I think you can pronounce his name Cora, and he's credited for pretty much inventing the half guard. Even though if you hear him in interviews, he'll say he didn't invent it; he perfected it. But every time anybody says anything, they say he invented it. And he kind of had the same story. I watched him on Flow Grappling Legends, and they say he had an injury. And he had to change his jiu-jitsu as well. And he started the half guard. And it's something that I've grown to, like, I was a takedown artist. I've wrestled since I was 8. I was like, I can take down anybody on the planet. And now, most of the time, I'm just in half. I love it. I'm just like, yeah, whatever. Yeah. I already know you're going to smash, and I'm going to let you do that for a little while, and then I'm going to start doing these chokes and sweeps. And then, oh, by the way, if you go to stand up, I also know how to wrestle. And, right. And
I was fortunate to meet Gordo in Miami. I went to a camp.
Nice.
Your camp down in Miami 3 years ago when the Henzo and Hajer and those guys were in Miami. That was an awesome 5 days. Gordo taught there. And then, you know, to meet that's what I loved, because everybody calls me half guard. That's like coach's half guard. But when I got to meet, and if he doesn't take credit for it, I you know, that's what I always heard. He was the founder of the half guard. So when I came back, I'm like, I met the guy and trained under the guy that pretty much created this position. That was one of the highlights of my jiu-jitsu career, meeting Gordo.
Yeah, he's so humble, because when I listened to him do the interview, they were kept saying he created it, and he just said no. He said it was a position that was already in jiu-jitsu, but nobody was attacking from it. It was, right. And he said, I started to learn how to attack and submit. And he said, so of course people will say I invented it. And he said, but you have to think. He said, what if there's somebody in Japan who I had never heard of who's doing this same thing and they never got famous? He says, who really invented it? We've never heard of each other. And I was just like, he's, you know, such a humble guy. And I was like, yeah, but in my head, yeah, my instructor invented half guard. you know.
And then you jump to the next, like that. I like studying coyote, that coyote half.
Yeah, so yeah.
That's a good one. But you got to get out to the side or you get guillotined.
So what is that guy named? Bernardo Ferreira?
Bernardo Ferreira, yeah.
So
Bernardo.
You know what's funny? I got your bottom half from Brandon, also known as Midwest Kong. And I was just like, okay, I'm going to start learning from him. 2 days ago, I saw your thing with Bernardo, and I started hitting it the other day. I was like,
yeah, that's a sneaky choke, that lapel choke.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
But they have to be pressuring forward. If it's either it backs them off, so you can just sit up. You can sit up. You know, you get your wrestling going.
You're
from the bottom. If they stand, but if they're coming forward, it's a lights out choke. Because they're pressuring.
Well, I still like it because most of us, the guys I roll with, they're strong cock diesel military, either Marine or Navy guys. So they all love to smash pass. I smash pass. So I kind of let them like, oh, yes, oh, my God, I'm getting killed. You're so strong. And I'm like, oh, no. I'm looking for this choke that I just saw.
Yeah.
And I got a guy with it, and he was like, oh, my God, you know, Daryl's so good. And I'm like, yeah, you know, get over time. And in my head, I'm like, I learned this 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Yeah. And isn't that the awesome thing about, like, you know, when you first started jiu-jitsu, access to information wasn't there. Now you can study. Like, I've been studying the lapel encyclopedia, you know, on my TV. You know, I can just study it 24/7. Like, I just, as soon as we get done talking, I'm going out to my TV and I'll start studying these guards. That's so at age 52, it's like I feel like I'm a kid because I never want to stop.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Daryl, just real quick, I actually have to leave. I got to go open up the gym to teach my kids.
Okay.
But, this has been really awesome. It's so nice to meet you, Todd. I really appreciate our conversation.
Nice.
And I wish you all the best in your gym.
Anytime you're in Monroe, swing by anytime and come train.
Of course. Bye, guys.
All right, Tara. All right, we love you. Teach those kids.
Love you. Bye.
So, yeah, I was going to ask you before we ended, I was going to ask, so you have Keenan coming. I just wanted you to talk about when that was going to happen and also your role that's going on tonight.
Okay, so I've had a lot of the high-level guys I mentioned earlier, you know, with JT, and this will be the first time Keenan. I've had Lucas Celebri, Bernardo Ferreira, Pedro Pajares, Luis Pajares. Keenan will be coming in. Let's see, I'm looking at the date. Next Saturday, which would be September 18th, which is already sold out, by the way, which he sold out pretty quick.
Keenan is good, man. I know, it was funny because when I got to jiu-jitsu, I literally always called myself a hobbyist because I never cared about sports jiu-jitsu stuff. I didn't watch jiu-jitsu film. And so I was, you know, kind of not maybe that was good because I wasn't polluted by it. So by the time I started to see who some of these guys are, they had already somewhat officially retired. And so I would be like, okay, I'm heavier, so Buchecha. And I'd be like, oh, I'm going to watch Buchecha. And then I'm like, oh, Buchecha versus Keenan Cornelius. And I just see him tying this big dude up. And that was like my introduction. I was like, oh. And, you know, and that was kind of my introduction to, and now it's like, I'm starting to study Wormguard and all these things. And I was like, I never would have thought about when I started in, I think, 2011. Or I wouldn't have.
Yeah, and I like to think of all the history of jiu-jitsu. Like, I've been so fortunate to meet and hang out and train, like, Marcelo Garcia, you know, Megaton, you know, Solo, Shanji, Andre Goval, you know, JT Torres, you know, and being able to actually roll with these guys and get my butt kicked and learn. There's the lapel system that I could be studying now, but then I could go back in time to Gordo and learn, go back in time and watch him again. I'll learn something else. So yes, it's never ending. Like, you could change your game tomorrow and say, you know what, I'm going to study old school close guard. And then you can play with that for a while. And that's the reason I think we can do this to our 100, because it is a game that never changes.
Yeah.
And there's so many great, cool people that you can learn from. And it just keeps you, to me, it's like every day I wake up, it's a new buffet.
Yeah.
It's like,
I feel like that too. I sponsor a lot of athletes. You know, I've been blessed in life to be able to. It's one of those things. People who don't care about money can create it really fast. So I can make money really fast, and I've never really cared about it. So I sponsor young athletes. You know, I sponsor Taylor. I sponsor her brother. He's fighting right now for Team Alpha Male. A couple of kids from my gym, and you know, I have a logo that I'm like, yeah, you want the logo, you can wear it. If not, whatever. You know, I don't care. But it's one of those things where I've run into that same thing. I'll meet these guys, and they will be so humble, and they won't tell you who they are. Like, I met the female, her name is Dominica, on Instagram. She's called Dom the Bomb, your mom. She's like a 7-time world champion. And I think, like, she's got, I think, like, 4 of them at black belt, 3 of them at blue, and so many. And I was like, I met her. She never's like, oh, by the way, I'm a world champ, you know. And I was just like, I'm learning, you know. I would just hear this girl in the corner, and I could hear every word she was saying, and she would say, now he's gonna do this and you do this, and I'd just be like, damn it, I wish I would have known she was a world champion when she, because I would have been trying to get these privates. And she came from Marcelo Garcia as well, that she was one of his black belts. And so it's just like, it is such a small, tight-knit community that I feel like I wanted to grow. But at the same time, I'm like, it's so special because it's so small. Because I get to meet so many people. And as somebody who's just getting into the history, I'm like, well, I didn't know who this guy was. You know, I just thought, like, you know, when I met Gordo, you know, that's what inspired me to try for the Worlds. And it was just like, he never said, oh, by the way, I'm one of the original blah, blah, blah. I'm a world champion. I conducted. I was a national team, whatever. I saw him. He came to, do a seminar here. And, you know, I was kind of like, who's this Gordo guy? You know, my instructor is Mark Saucer. He's a 3rd-degree black belt. My other instructor is Samson Saucer. He's a first. He's just got his black. Taylor Saucer, she's got her black belt. And their professor is Gustavo Machado. So when I go to a seminar, I go to Gustavo Machado. That's my lineage. I can be very stubborn sometimes when it comes to that, which I'm trying to break out of it, you know. And I'll be like, no, I don't know if that who this person is. I don't know if their stuff works. You know, whatever. I'm going to a Gustavo seminar. So when they brought in, they said, oh, no, this guy is Gustavo's instructor. I was like, oh, like a dumb moment. I was like, oh, somebody did have to teach him. Huh. But and so, you know, and then I started to look into Gustavo's lineage. And that's kind of like, I started to see, like, oh, my goodness, John Jock Machado. And I started to look at all these people. And now it's literally like that. I can just go and look at these YouTube videos of film after film after film. And I'm like, I now see these guys like I saw Dave Gable when I wrestled. And I was like, I was blessed when I was in high school to actually have parents who were able to send me to all these wrestling camps. And I was like, I got to go and get taught intensive camps to Dan Gable. You know, I got to go with Tom and Terry Brands and Royce Alger and all these people when I wanted to. My goal was to go to the Olympics, and I would go to Kurt Angle seminars when he was winning everything, and Kendall Cross and John Smith and all these people. And now, you know, I had a groin injury and my jiu-jitsu had to change. So it was just like, I was like, I can't throw my wrestling away because it was so much of my life, but I just can't, do drop steps like I used to and explode to people like I used to. And instead of getting, you know, depressed about it, it was like life just handed me a whole nother thing. And it was like, wait a minute, you know, your life's not over because you can't wrestle anymore. You know, now you literally have something. Samson is young. He's about 22. And when he got his black belt, he said something. I tell him sometimes, I say, sometimes for your age, you know, my brain will think you're like a Neanderthal. And then I say, but you'll say something to me and it'll be so profound. I'll be like, Jesus, you are Mark's son. And he teared up. You know, you get your black belt, you're crying and stuff. And he said, no matter what happens in life, he said, jiu-jitsu won't change. He said you can be depressed and you can go to the gym. He said your girlfriend can leave you and jiu-jitsu will be there. And he said jiu-jitsu will always be there. And I thought about it. I said, you're right. Even during the pandemic where people's gyms were closing and I thought it was dumb. It's just kind of how I am. But, you know, I kept thinking people want to be safe. And I was like, but then I saw people training in their garages, ordering mats for $300 and having secret practices. People putting up, you know, cardboard outside, like you can't see in here. And I thought, yeah, it doesn't have to be on TV. We are learning an art. I saw Jean-Jacques Machado teaching classes online, and I'd just be sitting there like, oh, okay, this is what they mean when they say hip case, and this is hawking, and this is, you know, and it was like by the time I got back to where we were opening our gym, I was like, well, I really haven't missed a beat. I came in at 225. During the pandemic, I got back down to 175.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I, during the pandemic, like, my wife now, we trained. Like, she was into it, but once that pandemic started, she was now she's addicted. Like, she started training, and, I mean, she's a blue belt, and she studies more than I study. Like, she's studying, I can hear it out on the TV right now. She's studying jiu-jitsu, so... Jiu-jitsu is one of those things, again, that you just hit it. It's like it's not going to go away. You can constantly learn, constantly evolve. But the biggest thing it does, man, it pulls all backgrounds from everywhere together, and you're on one mat, and you're having a blast, and it takes away the stress.
And you know what? There's so many beautiful moments that I see that I would have missed, and so many life lessons. I think we talked about this briefly when everything happened in Afghanistan. I saw these young kids, you know, and it's hard for me to be like kids. I'm only 36, you know, but to me, they're kids, you know, and I'm 10 years older than them, and they were just so distraught, and they were looking at the news, and I remember for the first 30 minutes, you know, they knew that I was, you know, prior military. They knew that I had been to the Middle East and blah, blah, and they asked me, like, what's your opinion on this? And I was just like, wait a minute, you know, this is kind of not why I come here. But I saw it in their eyes and I was like, look, guys. And I just sat down and talked to them. And, you know, and then they would ask me questions and I would just answer their questions. And I literally told them, I said, here's my number. I said, I'm very happy that you guys, one of them was only 19 years old. And I said, man, when I was your age, I was not in tune like this and engaged in this kind of stuff. I said, I'm so proud that you're concerned about this type of stuff at your age. You know, I said, because a lot of people could be going in a different direction. And I said, if you have a question, don't be frustrated. Text me. And I will literally do everything I can to accurately answer your question. I said, cut your TV off. You know, because I said, the media wants you to be outraged, but also... that's going to come to where you're going to feel so helpless because there's not, you know, and then that internal rage you have inside, you're going to turn it on your countrymen with different opinions. And so I would just kind of see like sometimes we would have these complex conversations, and I'd be like, oh my goodness, I would have never thought this person supported such and such. But because I got them through jujitsu first, how I would have demonized them or how they would have been demonized before, you know, now when somebody says something, I'm like, that's not true. You know, I know somebody who's a whatever, and that's not what they believe. You know, and, oh, well, how do you know? Because I've been rolling with him for 4 years, and he's never, you know, and it's like, so it's a very beautiful thing where it does bring these people together from all these different backgrounds. I remember we had a guy at the gym one time. He had a full on swastika. And we were just like, man, this guy's a Nazi. And so, you know, and then they were like, oh, no. That guy used to actually be a Nazi. He went to jail. He changed his life. Now he's like a Zen Buddhist. And he literally only keeps a tattoo to remind himself of how far he comes. And I was just like, oh, if, you know, if I would have saw that guy out in public, you know, I would have hauled ass and ran. direction, you know, and I was just like, wow, you know, and so one of the nicest guys you would ever want to meet, and I just asked him, you know, how he got into it, and, you know, I learned some things from somebody, from a source that I never would have got, and I'm like, yeah, jiu-jitsu gives you, you know, stuff like that, you know.
100%. Yeah, so, I mean, that's like having the police in the academy, you know, because I've had some guys that have served some time that are trained at my school, that I have the police. And so they're all on the mat together and they become friends. And that's, you know, in our town, you've got one side of town, you got this side of town. Yeah. When they get to my gym, it's one town. That's why I always look at it. And I say some of the kids that have been in trouble in their life, it's like, if I don't see them for a couple of weeks, I'm like, you know, they're gravitating back toward another influence in their life. And I'll hit them with a text. I hit him with a phone call and say, hey, man, come to this mat as many hours a week as you can, because it's so positive. It's such a positive influence in so many people's lives.
Yeah, it really is. And I found jiu-jitsu right at a hard time for me. Personally, refound it because the guy that raised me, my grandfather, passed away recently from COVID. And I kept thinking, like, you know, I got back into sport at the right time because I would have self-destructed, you know, and because how, you know, what an important figure he was in my life, in all of our lives, and because he was almost 90, you just felt like he was going to live forever, you know, and it was just that thing. I'm like, man, I remember literally my granddad been in my life from elementary school all the way through college, all the way through my military career, all the way out. And it was just like, so when, you know, COVID happened, the way he passed away just seemed so remarkably unfair to me because my family lives in Florida. You know, he was in the hospital by himself. They wouldn't let his wife in there with him. And, you know, my family practically called me and said, you need to say goodbye, and had him on a video. And, you know, and I just broke down, and then, you know, I cried and everything. But then immediately my brain went to how unfair this was for this amazing person and this military veteran and fought in Vietnam and the Korean conflict, and how could the government do him like this? He can't even have his family. And I was just furious. Right. And the only thing that calmed me was to be able to go to the gym every day and release that stress. And then I realized, you know, over time, I was like, well, this is not anybody's fault. You know, these people I see every day, I can't just, you know, snap on them. And it was something where I was like, yeah, you know, it works. Sometimes it's a workout. Sometimes it's you have an itch you want to be competitive. Sometimes it's a form of therapy.
100%. Yeah. 100%. And that's the reason, like, saying, like, you know, some of the people that will come in as an owner, professor, coach of my students, you know, be an encouragement. Like, I can tell, you know, I can see if somebody's down in the dumps. Maybe they just say, hey, that was a good scissor sweep. Good job today.
Yeah.
You know, or, hey, that was a, you know, you even if you got tapped 30 times in a roll, yeah, I was watching you roll, man, you're getting more and more technical. You know, those encouraging words, you never know how close somebody is to being in a really bad, bad spot in their life. And I feel like that's another thing as a school owner, is just an encouraging school. So they leave there when they go to their car. I want them to go, man, I'm glad I came. I never want them to go to the car and go, man, I wish I wouldn't have came.
Yeah, exactly. So on that note, I got one question. We have a really nice fight to win, and I'm kind of like you coming up right now. So your favorite jiu-jitsu practitioner right now, and I'm only going to let you pick three. who do you like right now that you think is the jiu-jitsu you kind of like to mimic? Like, not, it's an unfair question because I'm not talking about an instructor who's no longer competing. I mean, like, the young generation coming up, you know, the way they fight and train. Like, who do you like?
Mikey would be number one. The guy's a nonstop worker, super humble, super technical, and he goes for the finish.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I know a couple of the IBJJFs he went, you know, as an advantage in a couple of for the world championships a couple of years ago. I was fortunate to have him here for a seminar. I love his work ethic. I love his kindness. A super humble guy. So Mikey, and then Rutolo twins.
Yeah.
Gosh, man, those guys are nonstop. I mean, and then, you know, you have the Daisy Fresh. You're only letting me pick three, so I would say Mikey and the Rutolo twins, because they're just nonstop, and they're technical, and they're good. They seem like they're really good kids.
I had to make it hard for you. If you were a one stripe black belt, I would have gave you 10 people. but I had to make, as you get more advanced, I have to make it tighter for you. And you know what? I'm like that as well. I love the Daisy Fresh guys, because I like the rags to riches story. And I love Andrew Wiltse, just because of his no nonsense, go for the kill, sweep, you know.
And he doesn't wrestle. His wrestling is, he's getting wrestled up, you know, that his whole thing about, it looks like he's sitting guard and he's ready to come up. And
yeah, and I also like him because he will take tough matches, you know. There'll be a fight to win, and his attitude is so good because he'll say, you know, I try to be very nice to my opponents, and if they're trying to be mean to me, I'll walk away for a little while. And he's like, and I'll come back and try to joke with them some more, you know. And I was like, but then you watch him roll, and I'm like, oh, he's very in your face, tough, but then right in the match is over, he's very friendly, playful. And Mikey Musumeci's also, like, I put him and Andrew Wiltse kind of up there together. I like Mikey more just because I've always liked the smaller fighters, and Andrew's my size. He's 150, 185, and I listened to him on BJJ Mental Models the other day, and he said he actually should be 175. He just says he refuses to diet and eat right. He said he eats Panda Express every day, and so he was pretty funny, but he was just like, yeah. He was like, do you think I'm a natural heavyweight? He said, no. He said, I could actually be 165, 175. I just refuse to stop eating Panda Express. And I thought, wow, you know, like, what a real, you know, moment. Yeah.
And their work ethic. I mean, they work so, I look at workers because, you know, with my background in running, I never felt like I was talented. I always acted like I was on the JV trying to make the varsity. So I love hard workers, and I love people that are dedicated. And it seems like, you know, as much as those guys train at Daisy Fresh, you can see how his game is elevated too. Like, not only is he aggressive, he's super technical. His passing is amazing. He's nonstop. His conditioning, he may say he's eating Panda Express or whatever, but something's going in his gas tank for him to bring the heat. I mean,
see,
he's like,
my thing is, I feel like as a human being, I always tell people you need to be able to do both. If you want to drink, you just need to know you have to pay for that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're going to have to go to the gym and work a lot harder. I'm not going to give you a diet unless you ask me for it, but I'm going to tell you this may not be good for you in this type of sport. And so I like that. I like Mikey because I do like his attitude. Like, it was actually pretty funny that Taylor's gone, because we had a nice little debate with the Gio Martinez and Mikey Musumeci thing, and I wrote a nice long post personally to Gio when the whole thing happened, and I just said, you know, you talked a lot of trash and this kid never said anything to you. And I just said, you were the one that, you know, he blah blah blah, and I just said, if you're gonna talk trash, at least win. And it was, you know, it was one of those things where, and I told them when I got to the gym, they were like, did you see my, your comment had 900 and something likes and blah, blah. And I said, I want you guys to know I actually like Gio Martinez. I really love him. And I said, but I felt like he did this thing where he made me pick sides. And I was like, I'm going to always pick the side of the guy not talking trash. And I was like, but... I said, I know in human nature, you like the fighter that talks trash. I was like, we like Mike Tyson. We like Muhammad Ali. We like, you know.
Conor McGregor.
Yeah, and I said, yeah. So I carry two sets of books because of what I want in larger society. I said, I want somebody who will hype a fight and do that thing. But then I said, but it's different when I see, like, well, somebody's not responding. And my brain was like, well, now it seems like bullying. Like, you're just, you're doing this to this kid. You know, he's saying we're friends, and he's like, oh, you ain't my friend. And I'm just like, and then I kept seeing Mikey. He doubled down. He was like, my good friend. And so he really gained my respect because I said he wouldn't come out. He wouldn't do it, say anything negative. He let his jiu-jitsu do the talking. And then after the match, then he talked a little bit of trash.
And the thing is, spending the weekend here with Mikey, like when he came in on a Friday, left on a Sunday, you know, Mikey even admits on his interviews, like he's socially awkward. You know, his interviews, he even says, look, this is tough for me. He's not good in front of like the interview. Like Mikey loves jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
Mikey wants to, that's all he wants to do is train 6 to 8 hours a day. And I think when he gets in conflict, that day you can see it threw him off, right? He's not used to it.
Yeah, he didn't like it, and you could, you know, we do a lot of body language stuff in psychology, and you could see it all over his face when they said you're fine. They said he talked trash. His whole face in that interview before the thing, his whole face mannerism changed. He was somebody you could read that he was very uncomfortable. You know, he just was not interested. So I thought, like I said, you know. I sponsor some independent media shows as well. So I don't know if you ever heard of Rear Naked Radio. It's just a jiu-jitsu podcast. I'm one of the major sponsors for that because I know Jamie Kilstein. And Jamie trains at 10th Planet Austin. So when I came out and said what I said about Gio, Jamie was like in my inbox and we were kind of talking back and forth. And I was just like, you know, Jamie came out and put a video out vouching for Gio and vouching for Mikey, saying these two are like very great people and they've done more than most of us have done in our entire lives. And I watched that video and it kind of softened me a little bit, but I was still like, Jamie, your friend is the one that started the trash talking. Like, yeah. You know, but then I backed off. I was like, you know what? It's just fun and games. They have to sell the fight, you know. But I was kind of, you know, messing with Gio a bit. He's like, oh, yeah, you know, he may be able to do this, but would he fight me in EBI? And I said, oh, that's like me saying, I was like, isn't EBI stands for Eddie Bravo Invitational? And that's where you got your black belt?
Did he say something about combat?
Yeah.
Did he say combat?
And so he was just like, well, you would fight me in this. And I'm just like, yeah, you keep asking him to fight you in stuff that your instructor makes. I say that's like saying you can't beat me in my gym when my instructor sets the rule set verbally that I like. I said,
right.
That's not the point. The point was he signed up for this fight to win or whatever it was. He fought valiantly at 135 after not doing no geese, you know, forever. He came and literally has been knocking off the top people at 135, at 145, then jumped to 155. I was like, you had to respect it. Now, the fact that he's not doing that thing that people do where they're just playing it safe, I was like, yeah, he's doing what traditional jiu-jitsu is supposed to be about. A smaller person saying, my technique can let me beat these bigger people. And so that's why, like, right now, he's like my number one. And
you know, speaking of posting, I remember the only time I really, because I got my little Instagram, and Gordon Ryan, you know, they had camp down in Florida. So, like, JT was there, Gordon was where, Mikey was, and they all rolled together. It was like a super pro camp that somebody put together. And Gordon was talking about the people he was rolling with. And I checked onto Gordon's page, and I said, what did you think about Mikey? And he came back, and he goes, what was his quote? He said, I'm going to stay up all night trying to figure out a way to get that kid. It was my toughest role of the day. So even Gordon Ryan at his weight going against Mikey was so impressed with Mikey's jiu-jitsu. That told me if Gordon Ryan is saying that about Mikey, then you gotta the kid's just like, he's amazing.
It's just amazing. It was that. I hadn't seen that quote, but I was watching, you know, I pay for Flow Grappling. I feel like they have the more exciting fights. I like the fight to wins. I love the fight to wins, and you know, and Gordon did an interview, and Gordon said, to this day, I still have not passed Mikey Musumeci's guard. And I was like, whoa. I was like, I gotta pay attention to this kid, because when I got back into jiu-jitsu, which has been very recent, I think I've only been back for about 9 months or so, everybody was talking about the Danaher Death Squad. So I was all, you know, so the loudest person is Gordon. It's so, you know, I'd just be looking at Gordon stuff and I'd be like, well, his politics are kind of crazy. And but I would be like, but that's just because he's 25. You know, and he's very this or that. And I expect you to be like that at 25. But I always respected the fact that I would write him messages on his Instagram and he'd respond back. Yeah. And, you know, he was always very respectful. You know, he would troll everybody he was fighting, but he'd be like, oh, you know, Mr. McClain, blah, blah. I'd be like, oh, this kid can't be as bad as, you know, everybody's saying he is.
He's putting on a show. It's a promotion, too. He's self-promotion, you know.
Yeah, but and I listened to him in an interview, and he said that. He said his instructor, Danaher, told him, if you don't have a personality, you're not going to make any money. And so, so when I heard the interviews, I said, oh, so it's a gimmick. And then I would watch his matches and I would say, well, his jiu-jitsu kind of speaks for itself. He does a lot of trash talking, but I said, but so did Muhammad Ali, you know, and if you can back it up, that we could do. And so that was just my thing. So I got Andrew Wiltse, I got Mikey Musumeci, and I also, right now, I'm like going old school, but I still do. I love, even though he's kind of retired now, I just love the way Buchecha can slow it down and then just grind it out when it's time. Yeah. And now I'm getting into Keenan Cornelius a lot because I started using lapels. So right.
To me, like, if you're going in, like, back a little bit, like JT Torres is, you know, he was here and that guy's jiu-jitsu is old. It's, he can counter the new school with wrestling and his pressure. Like, he doesn't really play, you know, he's not playing lapel, he's not playing in no-gi, you know, he uses good, solid base wrestling and pressure. And he doesn't have to use any of the new stuff because that's what he does. And like, so I'm a fan of that type of game too. I kind of like the new innovative blah, 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 but you give me a good solid wrestler that has great jiu-jitsu. I like that, man. Somebody like Hajar Gracie. Think about Hajar. Not really a great wrestler, but Hajar was a pressure fundamental. I'm going to mount you and I'm going to choke you without anything special. Or I'm going to get you in my closed guard. I'm going to go 2-on-1. I'm going to get your back. I'm going to do a flower sweeper. I'm going to do a, you know, I'm going to mount you. I like kind of that. When I see the old school win in the new era, I love.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of you.
See, and I forgot, speaking of Hajar Gracie, the person that I really respect and like now is Lovato Jr. And I love his attitude, and I just love his, you know, very simple. And I tell people I carry two sets of books. I pay attention to all the new school stuff. I bought the Leg Entanglements DVDs, you know, I bought the, you know, Cyborg stuff, but I was like, my brain tells me what you guys aren't studying. I'm going to go study that because, you know, I will just study the defenses to the stuff you guys are trying. And I'm going to go back and learn all the basics, because even when I see people who are leg entanglement gods, well, they all end with chokes and arm bars. Because the leg entanglements, they'll cancel each other out, and then they go to basic jiu-jitsu. And I'm like, yep, so why don't I just learn the basics, learn the fundamentals, get very good and technical with the stuff that the founders create it, because now everybody's ignoring it. And my brain right. says, if you don't have a foundation, your whole house is built on Jell-O pudding. And, right. And it's like, and I just feel like, all right, it's like seeing the guy with a big chest and chicken legs. Like, well, I'm right. just going to kick you and you're going to fall over. And so that's the little game I play in the gym. I'll look at somebody and they'll be like, oh, yeah, he's a wrestler, blah, blah, blah. And we got some NCAA qualifiers. I'm like, well, cool. Thanks for telling me he doesn't know jiu-jitsu. So I'm literally going to sit on my butt, and I have taken away the takedown now. And right. now what are you going to do? Yeah. And yeah. then after I've worn him out for 4 minutes, oh, by the way, I also know how to wrestle. So now I'm going to wrestle you. But right. but now you have that in your head. Do I really want to take him down? I'm like, that's yeah. when the fun starts.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So true, man. So true.
So my last question, because I'm one of those, like, I could talk to you all day about this stuff, is you have an event going on in the next few hours. Tell me a little bit about that.
So 6:20 tonight, we'll start it at 6:20. We're going to do a 51-minute straight roll. It's in honor of my college teammate, great friend, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu blue belt, military veteran, state champion runner. I could brag about him all day long. He was a state trooper up here in Michigan. So September 9th, 2013, state trooper, routine traffic stop up in northern Michigan. Susie said license registration. The guy had a 357 Magnum. There, he had some drugs in the car. Was out of his mind and shot Paul in the head and killed him. Wow. The call was in at 6:20. And Paul was the 51st state trooper in the state of Michigan that died in the line of duty. So what I do is, his nickname was Butter because his last name's Butterfield. Butterfield. So in college we'd call him Butter, and we're just really good friends. And so I started something 3 years ago called the Butter Roll. In honor of Paul, and we'll roll. We start at 6:20, and then we'll finish it up 51 minutes later. So people pick partners. As long as you're rolling, you can roll with different partners, but you're rolling 51 minutes straight. I try to raise money for Fallen Trooper Fund, for officer training programs, anything that I can do to help in the honor of Paul. That's what we're starting. That's what I started 3 years ago. And, we'll have officers coming. We got people coming in from down in Ohio, and, probably have a couple of years ago, we couldn't do it last year because of the pandemic. A couple of years ago, we had, 60, 70 people on the mat rolling. So it's a good thing. I like to make it go nationwide. I like to get the water rolling.
So what I want to, that's a really good cause, and what I want to do is, I think right now I sponsor like 6 fighters. I want to get them in on it. So obviously they're going to miss out this year, but I want to see, I know they would love to travel to see if I can get them to your gym next year when you do it. So one of the kids I sponsor, his dad works for the sheriff's department in Norfolk, and he's thinking about going to the police academy himself. So it's something that I would like to get them in on, because they're very young. As a matter of fact, Taylor's the oldest person I sponsor, and she's only 25. So gotcha. I just want to have, and I do that because I feel like I want to, when I see them doing something good, I want to keep them on the right path. And so I'll stay in contact. So when it happens, I'll book their flights and everything, or they're big on Airbnbs and stuff nowadays, right.
It's something I wish, I just had the idea of the Butter Roll, right? So it's something I wish it could go nationwide for awareness of, like we talked about earlier, officers, most officers are good people. The media focuses on the bad apples, but also officers need more training. So the funding, if it's $5, whatever the funding can be, my school is free for any officer. Like, any officer comes from Virginia, they come into my school, they're training for, any officer can train in my school for free.
Nice.
But if funding that needs to be had, that on top of kind of the education that schools, when an officer comes in, they need to know, look, here's what we're going to be training at our school. It's just not about, cross chokes, and we're going to be doing mount escapes and the things that they are going to learn, like a curriculum that makes sense to the officer. Because somebody that hasn't trained before and they're an officer, a younger officer, they're not gonna know what they're going into. Maybe they YouTube it and go, I don't see how that's applicable for what I'm gonna do. Okay. You know, so I think the influence and funding and just the overall awareness of how important officers are in our communities.
Like,
that's what I'm trying to bring awareness to.
I totally agree. My friend Jamie Kilstein, who does Rear Naked Radio, always says, man, I could talk to you all day, and I'm off work, so I could literally talk to you for the next forever. So is there anything else you'd like to say before we end?
No, just if anybody's ever in Monroe, Michigan, come to Monroe. Just, you can train, have a good time. If you're out there anywhere, keep rolling, stay healthy, and surround yourself with good people. Make smart decisions and live your life to the fullest.
All right, guys, that is Todd Williams of Monroe Jiu-Jitsu, and I'm going to link to him, his accomplishments. I stole his pictures off his website. I'm going to put those up in the show notes so you can look at it. And if you're in Michigan, you can check him out at his gym. And, guys, what an amazing interview and very easy flowing, very good guy. You can kind of tell from the flow of the conversation that he is very genuine. So I'm going to link to everything that he has doing, his jiu-jitsu lineage, his track career, etc., in the show notes so you can find him. And we're going to keep in touch for everything that he has, trying to get as much positivity out there in the world as possible. At any rate, thank you for tuning in to the show, and see you on the next episode. The Darrell McClain Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. Get a membership at www.patreon.com/The Darrell McClain Show.